Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. So we are so packed today. This is one of those days where I hope everything goes right because we've got Jane Adams who's going to start with our medical freedom report. In fact, she's there right now. We've got a very special guest. We had some problems last week coordinating this and getting all our technology going, but by Skype, John's going to be John Cullen is going to be joining us, and John Cullen is just brilliant. In fact, Jane, I don't know if you know who he is, but feel free to either listen or catch the podcast or whatever you can, and bring this information to your group. He is just a wealth of incredible stuff, talking about how the real killer in this whole COVID thing is flu. The resurrection of the Spanish flu. We started to talk about it last week. It never quite got through. And this is the episode that Judy Mikovits was on. So I'm hoping to get both of them together at some point. But and then we've got Claire Lopez in the third hour. And we just have an incredible amount of things to talk about with everything from Afghanistan. And I'm also curious about her views on the resistance, about what's happening here between Southwest and all the different groups. And I'll ask Jane about that as well. I really think we called it right. Jane, good morning. I think we nailed it Tuesday when we said that this country has moved from compliance to resistance. I think we were absolutely right on. And so let me know what you think, and then I'll bring on Jane and we'll talk medical freedom.
No, I definitely think that's true. And I just want to make a quick comment, and I don't know if you've heard this, but in Texas, there was a hospital then, I don't know which one, but a person went and talked to a nurse that came out of a bus, and there was a whole bunch of medical people coming out of the bus. And I'll talk fast because I know she's waiting, but the bus had FEMA employees on it. A lot of hospitals in Texas are mandating the COVID shots, which is ironic since the governor supposedly said you cannot do that. But anyway, these people, medical people coming off the FEMA bus, guess what? They don't need to have the vaccine.
Well, of course not. They're government people. Government people are exempt from everything.
So isn't that ironic that FEMA is sending people over there? And so this person that was telling who asked this nurse, well, they were wondering if this isn't a way for government to take control over the hospitals.
Ooh.
So anyway,
that note.
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Just thought how ironic that FEMA doesn't have to have their medical employees vaccinated, but hospitals are mandating it. So they're firing unvaccinated medical people and bringing in unvaccinated medical people. Now explain that.
See, I thought they were going to enforce this in Massachusetts. They've got the National Guard has been called out, and I think they're going to try and enforce these mandates. Anyway, let's give a round of applause. And bring on our wonderful new reporter to Action Radio, Jane Adams, with the Medical Freedom Report.
Good morning.
Are you listening to all this stuff? And have you heard anything about FEMA in Texas before we get to the rally and all the other cool things going on? Jane?
Good morning. Hi. I had not heard that, but that's very interesting. And, I mean, I love what's going on in Texas with the governor. So that's exciting and interesting.
Well, there's two things going on, too, because I just read a story. Yahoo News had a thing last night that one of the counties, I think Leon County here in Florida, just got fined, $30 million by either the governor or the state for pushing an illegal vaccine mandate. Did you hear anything about that?
I did hear something about that because I've been watching that county. I've been watching a couple counties in Florida, but I need to research that more, but I did hear – I saw one article on that.
Yeah. I want to explain to folks, too, we're not in the business of breaking news. That is not our job. There's plenty of sources out there where you can get the latest and greatest. I mean, we talk about these things just because we like to talk about them because it's new and exciting, and we're going to find out about it. But our real goal here is about solutions. We are not here to tell you all the problems. In fact, I get my news, you know, a lot of places you get your news. Okay. So that's not the issue. What's different about this show is what we do about it. And so if we don't have the latest, greatest news, I mean, hey, you got other sources. But if you want to know where to go with it, this is pretty much the only place you can go that I know of that actually is a news program that has solutions, that writes legislation, that is an activist. That is our job here. You know, any pretense of journalism went out the window years ago. And so I don't even bother with it. I'm not an objective person. I'm not a journalist. I'm an advocate. You know, I'm a citizen legislator. And the more that I can increase and include that number, the better for this country, because this is how we're going to get our freedom, is by empowering people to do things they never thought possible. Anyway, speaking of doing things they never thought possible, what's going on in medical freedom?
We had an amazing freedom rally this past Tuesday in Pensacola. And speaking of action, that is action steps and the doctors that put that on and who spoke were so inspirational and encouraging to me. We had Dr. Peter McCullough streamed in live and was part of the panel. We had Dr. Ryan Cole and Dr. Ben Marble. We had several amazing speakers, the lawyer, Mr. Jeff Childers. The one that really spoke to my heart and was so inspirational was she's a nursing midwife who escaped the Czech Republic, Yana Benin. She's also the host of Israeli Live Radio. And she spoke about how she is seeing all of these signs of communism in the United States right now. And she said, you know, it's not a matter of is it coming or when it's coming. It's already here now. And she spoke about her experience escaping communism from the Czech Republic and basically warning, you know, the people of Pensacola to rise up and resist what's happening right now because it's the first signs of control. And so that was just very, you know, we've all kind of known that it's happening, but just to see her speak about it when she has firsthand experience was eye-opening. And I'm so thankful that the doctors group put that on and gave her the opportunity to share that experience. And I talked to a lot of people after the rally that remembered her speech, you know, very vividly and were inspired by that. So that was definitely some great action steps this past Tuesday. That rally was amazing, and I look forward to further rallies in Pensacola and the one coming up on October 23rd in Tallahassee.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that in a second, but what I found so amazing about the rally was the amount and the quality of speakers in that panel. I don't think a lot of us really knew. I think, if anything, I think the publicity could be improved upon a little bit because I know some folks didn't hear about it. They thought it was canceled. Mm-hmm. And even though we had a really great crowd out there, we probably could have had more folks. And this is just a learning experience. But I don't know how, I guess, and I spoke to a couple of people after the rally. I spoke to Dr. Ryan Cole. I spoke to Dr. Deborah Biglini. And I spoke to the attorney, Jeff Childers. Childers? I hope I pronounce it right.
Yes.
Anyway.
I think it's Childers.
Okay, good. Well, he'll tell us. I get corrected all the time on the info. But what's interesting is that how do these folks come together? Yeah, that's an incredible panel, you know, of people, and plus the ones I didn't mention. The Marine person, Twombly, I believe is the last name.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the speakers. In fact, you might as well just mention everybody that was there that spoke because it's an incredible list of people. How do all those folks come together so fast? Was that Dr. Biglioni that did that? Did you do that? Was there a group? I mean, it's just – someone needs credit for
so
doing
a
really
group,
nice job.
Yeah. Dr. Biglione, she has been, you know, public and outspoken that she's the one that kind of coordinated the rally, but she had help from obviously a lot of people. There's a whole team behind it. That was put together in less than 2 weeks. And so, like you said, it is a learning experience, and I believe they're going to have another one next month. But I think it was amazing for, you know, such short notice that was thrown together in less than 2 weeks, and I think that's amazing.
Well, for that, it's incredible.
Group,
yeah, no, I'm not trying to criticize. Yeah. I'm just saying that what people have told me is like, oh, I had one person that commented on my Facebook page. I thought it was canceled. You know, I would have gone if I'd known. And, of course, I talked about it for a couple of weeks. So it's not like, you know, and I post the banner, you know, for a long time, but it's not, you know, and people really need saturation advertising. It's got to be there. If the big TV stations had said, guess what, big rally coming up. You know, be there. We'll be covering it. You know, it would have made a huge difference. Was there any TV coverage? I didn't see the WEAR cameras anywhere or anybody in particular.
I think that's part of the problem with getting the word out is that a lot of the media doesn't want to cover this type of rally. I know I personally reached out to several of the local news stations to announce that it was coming up or be there and, you know, do interviews and highlight it. But unfortunately, it's not something that the mainstream wants to notify the public of. And so that's one of the barriers that we have, not only with that rally, but, you know, with the protests that we're doing, with the petition, with lawsuits, I mean, everything that kind of stands in our way. So right now we're relying on word of mouth, social media, email, text message.
Action radio.
We would love action radio. you know, we would love for the hear from one of the doctors that WEAR was supposed to be there, and I didn't personally see them. But going back to your question about, you know, who put it together and who's kind of behind it, there's a group of doctors. They're called the Panhandle Doctors for Truth, and it's about, I believe it's up to about 40 doctors right now. The majority of them are Ascension Sacred Heart physicians, but there are several others who are not associated with that hospital. They're at other hospitals or they have their own clinics. And that is so inspiring to me and to others, many people that I talked to at the rally. And they are inspired that physicians are coming out and being bold and brave, you know, communicating with each other, having meetings, and coming up with a plan to resist the mandates and fight for early treatment. That's their main message is, you know, they're not aggressive or, you know, trying to cause an, you know, an uproar or anything like that, but they're just fighting
that
for their patients.
That's my job. Yeah. Well, and here's
they're
the thing,
fighting
too,
for their patients. So
are they public?
I think that's
Can
amazing.
We identify these folks or are they staying anonymous? Is it a secret group or I don't want to cause many grief for what they're doing. Yeah.
The only ones that I feel comfortable identifying are the ones that, you know, spoke out at the rally. So the other ones I have not.
No, that's fine. Listen, I want to protect the anonymous and I want to, you know, I mean, you don't have to be public to do good work. And so I don't want to get in the way of that one bit.
Yeah.
I don't mind being public and I don't mind stating, you know, huge things. I mean, I see that as my job. I mean, I'm supposed to be public. But the folks that aren't, who do have jobs that are at stake, see, one of the reasons I'm an independent broadcaster from any network or boss or anything like that is so that I can say what I want. And so, but to do that, you know, that's a risk because it's much easier to be in a radio format and have a boss and a regular paycheck and all those kind of things. And I chose a different route to do that. And I think a lot of people do too, that are choosing, you know, and well, here's kind of like, I guess it's more theoretical or just perception because there's no definite answer for this, but the tide is turning. People are now being supported for not getting the vaccine, where they were shunned and embarrassed and coerced and peer pressured. Now, it's almost popular now to not get it. And there's the support. And you look at Southwest, you look at Amtrak, you look at American Airlines now. The most popular post on my Facebook page is the announcement that Amtrak and American have joined Southwest. I mean, people are ready for this. I wish they were here a year ago.
Yeah.
I've been saying this since March of 2020. This is all, I said, the virus is real, but everything else is a hoax. The lockdowns, mass closures, school closures, everything else. There's no reason for any of it. And so I'm like, well, where y'all been? I've been doing this for, you know, a year and three quarters now. But it takes a while. I guess you have to build like the critical mass. You got to build a certain amount of momentum. You got to have a certain number of people that are doing it so that the others feel comfortable joining. And I think we've reached that critical mass where enough people have been out front, have stuck their necks out, have done enough to be public about what's happened that the other people that wouldn't necessarily do it that might be in the coercion category. And I went over this over the last couple of days. There's three categories of people in this country right now. There's the compliant, who just get the vaccine and they just do it because they're told to. They're sheep, right? You've got the resistant, you know, me, everybody else like me, of the folks that are resisting on the jobs, the health workers, the airline pilots, everything else like that. And then you got the group in the middle, and the group in the middle is the one we need to reach. It's like independents. There's Republicans, Democrats, and independents. So we need the folks that are in the middle, the coercion group, the group that doesn't want to do it but feels they have to. And that's the group we need to reach the most, because that is where you're going to – if we can swing the coercive group over to the resistant group, we're done. We can lock this government up. We can lock them down and say, no, you're not going to take a mandate. Screw you. And the more they proclaim,
yep.
you know, their mandates, and the more they try and dictate to us, the more people are going to resist and say, no, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to arrest all of us? No, ain't going to happen. We're going to shut down the whole country. And that's where we're headed right now, which is really encouraging. You know, it's a very peaceful, very direct revolution, but it's a very in-your-face revolution. It's open defiance, but there's enough people now openly defying that I think the majority of people will feel more comfortable openly defying with us and join the resistant group. What do you think?
Yep. I agree. I think that, you know, you said the tide is turning, and I feel that too. Like you mentioned, the all of the airlines are rising up, the NBA mm-hmm. players. I don't know if you've seen, you know, their interviews.
Oh, tell me about that. I'm not familiar. What's going on?
So there's several NBA players who are not taking the vaccine, and they're being fined millions of dollars per game because they haven't gotten it.
Oh, really?
His name escapes me right now, but he's one of the top players in the league, and he risks losing his career over this. And he says that he's not getting it because he doesn't want it himself, but it's also protesting vaccine mandates. And so that is just amazing to see, you know, it kind of feels sometimes like we're in this fight alone, but like you're saying, you know, there's more and more people, not just in this circle or, you know, in the healthcare circle, but it's airlines, it's NBA players, you know, I know there's a lawsuit against the federal government, you know, happening, and their mandate has been put on pause because of that. And so it's happening across markets, across the nation. And I think we're normalizing the unvaccinated, we're normalizing resistance, and that is exactly what we need.
Yeah, I always hate the term unvaccinated. We use it for convention, but I prefer like DNA normal or unaltered or healthy or something. Any other term?
Yeah.
Language is so critical, and I call them vaccine injured. And somebody else was doing that too on the show recently too. They use exactly the same term, vaccine injured, and so we should feel sorry for the vaccine injured that they were coerced into doing something probably against their will. But this is there's something really fascinating, and I've got to Christina, our producers here too. Gina, if people want to join this, you know, anytime, you know, feel free, especially. Or you know, check on live chat, and we've got to, like I say, John joining us in about 43 minutes here. So he's got some statistics that are just incredible. But anyway, tell me about what else is going on, the other rallies, the doctors that you talk to, anything else that's happening right now. What's going on?
So we have another rally that's going to be happening in Tallahassee at the Florida State Capitol Building, October 23rd, 1 o'clock p.m., and I'm very excited for that one because I think it's going to be an amazing turnout. I would love all of your listeners to drive over and support us. There's going to be several speakers. Some are the one of the main people organizing it is Mr. Luis Miguel. He's running for U.S. Senate. And I connected with him the day after our mandate came out.
Okay.
And he has been so helpful. He's wonderful. He advocates for medical freedom. And so he's going to be speaking. We're going to have, I can't tell you who, but one of the doctors that spoke on Tuesday at the Pensacola rally is going to be speaking at that rally. And the goal of that rally is to just bring awareness and put pressure on the legislators to stand up for the state of Florida and protect our rights against mask mandates and vaccine mandates.
Do you have any particular bills? Because legislators, they need something. They need direction. They're like little kids running around there. So the more you can make their life easier. It's like reporters. You want to give them the story because reporters are now lazy as you know anybody else. But if you can have specific bills or if you highlight the governor mandate, you know, the vaccine mandates are illegal. You know, and say, hey, we just want to support the governor in this. You know, we want to say, and this is it. Here's his executive order number, you know, 32568, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. But find the number of the executive order. Find the laws. Find the specifics. And, of course, that helps the media, too, because they're lazy. So you want to provide them with the information and say, hey, you know, here's what we're supporting. There's the governor's executive order number, you know, and here's the legislation or proposed legislation. If you have some people that are proposing stuff, my person that I used to talk to a lot, well, he's kind of busy now. He's running for Congress and, you know, but Anthony Sabatini, who actually had lawsuits with his law firm against mask mandates and different mandates like that. You know, he's someone that might have stuff in the works. You know, are there any bills that he'd be a good person to ask too, if you can, In fact, Dr. Leo might have a better chance, you know, of just talking to him and saying, hey, you know, what's in the works? What have you proposed? Because if you can bring about proposed legislation for the next session, now you're already introducing people to the idea. So you're building a consensus, you know, for legislation that most people don't even know about yet. But if it's already there, if it's been filed, you can go, hey, let's highlight this. And we've got, you know, a little while. Today is what, the 14th, 20th? So the 20th, so you have a week and a bit. 23rd is a week Saturday, so you got, you know, what, 9 days.
Yeah.
So you can do a lot of things in 9 days. But, you know, talk to the organizers, talk to the folks, and just it wouldn't take much research to find out what bills are already available. Get to the governor's office, maybe talk about the executive order. Is anybody from the governor's office coming down to speak at this? That would be something cool.
I believe so.
Okay.
I need to confirm that, but I believe so. And I love that idea of having specific, you know, bills or orders that we're highlighting to make it easier. So I love that idea.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been in this game for a while. I wasn't born yesterday. But yeah, it's just once you know the psychology of these people, and the more you do this, the more you'll find out. You'll find out how you'd be able to save so much time by just by them, because you can do the best rally in the world. And people, I'm not a big rally person because a lot of times, you know, I've already been studying the issue for a long time, but I want to be able to take the information. But for a lot of people, rallies are a great way to introduce them to the topic. So you know, be real straightforward, really simple, really direct. And sometimes people get too complicated. I think some of the speakers, this is a suggestion. I mean, it was a great rally, but you can lose people if you get too complicated in too many details. And we go to a lot of details on the show, but I do it in a timeline and I do it in segments and we have different things so that, you know, this would be, I mean, I admit my own show is a hard thing to listen to for 3 hours straight because there is so much material. There's so many things that we go over that I recommend people, you know, take the pieces that you want. And the same thing with speakers too. Be direct, state what you want, you know, give a body of evidence, state what you want again, you know, but make it really simple. We want medical freedom. We don't want vax mandates. You know, just take the chance that people say, hey, hey, ho, ho, you know, vaccine mandates have to go. You know, I mean, I kind of like that one. But, I mean, you want to bring it right. You want to be simple and complex. You want to have simple goals that people can latch onto because that's what they're going to remember. Then you want to have, you know, some evidence so people know you know what you're talking about. And then you go back to the simple goals again. And this is what we want. We want this bill. We want this executive order. We want, you know, media, are you listening? The tide has turned. I mean, that'd be a great theme for the rally on the 23rd. The tide has turned from compliance to resistance. You know, this is why I write this stuff. This is why I talk about it. You know, it just pops out of my head. I'm just, you know, you don't want my brain. My brain is ADHD beyond belief. And so, but all this stuff comes out. Take it. Take the things that we talk about. Use them. Feel free. If it sounds good to you.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah. Okay. All right, what else do you want
to
cover?
I have one more thing that I wanted to announce.
Okay, please.
So I can't give any details, but there's going to be a major lawsuit against Ascension Healthcare nationwide.
Okay. Class action?
It's not class action. It's going to be individual lawsuits by, well, I'm not going to give the number of plaintiffs. But,
No. But it's multiple?
It's,
multiple individual?
It is, yes. Okay. Several.
Don't say what you can't. I don't want to ruin the lawsuit, but just the fact that it exists, people know this is huge.
This is not, you know, this is just one of many that's happening across the nation. And I didn't realize that Ascension is the largest Catholic healthcare system in the world.
Oh,
and so that's huge. And I know this is happening to many other hospital systems. So again, and I think we're headed in the right direction.
You know, it's fascinating. I don't know if you worked with this at all. As soon as I hear Catholic, I know the Catholic stance, at least it used to be, the stance on abortion. And there's fetal tissue in these vaccines. So the idea that a Catholic hospital, maybe you can use this too, that a Catholic-based hospital, which is ardently against abortion, has been ever since, you know, it came about, is using aborted fetal tissue in a product that they're mandating. I don't know if hypocrisy really covers it, but, you know, and I don't know if you can use that, but to me, that is the height of arrogance, hypocrisy, and just absolute, go ahead. You know, how dare
they? Everyone I've spoken to, which is, I'm connected with thousands of Ascension employees across the nation. Everyone has been using that, and Ascension has denied all of the religious exemptions. That's part of
Wait. A Catholic-based hospital has denied the religious exemptions? Can we put this into the hypocrisy category, too?
It's unbelievable when you think about it. They're offering, you know, they're saying that they're offering the medical and the religious exemptions because they're required to, but when it comes down to it, they're really not because they're denying all of them. Of the 2,000, I think we're up to like 2,200 members in the Facebook group that we just use to communicate with each other.
Right.
Not one person on there has been approved. And so religious discrimination, and that includes people who have had religious exemptions approved in the past. And so they've had for years, you know, a track record, history documented religious exemptions from the flu vaccine. And now all of a sudden they're not being approved for the flu vaccine or the COVID-19 vaccine for exemptions. And so it's just asinine what's happening, especially from a Catholic organization.
Yeah, this is amazing. Get back to the lawsuit for a second, and you may not be able know this yet. What is their goal? Are they just trying to overturn the mandates? Are they seeking damages? Because I think these people should be arrested for what they're doing. I'm not quite sure what you charge them with, but at least civil damages, you know, because you're forcing people to risk their own, you know, life and health for something that's going to be proved dangerous, you know, at some point anyway. These people, I believe, are all going to get their jobs back. The NBA star is going to get his career back. You know, I believe a lot of these suspensions and firings are temporary because they're going to need these people. And who are you going to get to do the job? Well, the people that already know it. You know, so do you know the goals of the lawsuit yet? Has that been established, or are we still in the formative stages?
Yeah, that has been established. I can't release any more details, but that is it has been established, and I totally agree with what you're saying.
Okay. Well, we'll talk further about it. The last thing I want to leave you with is Sheriff Johnson here in Santa Rosa County, Florida, had a video. He just posted it last night. I've reported on it. I posted it on my Facebook page. But he has told his employees, which are all the deputy sheriffs of Santa Rosa County, Florida, that it's their choice. And so what I would do if you get a chance, reach out to Sheriff Johnson. I have to. I'm going to try and get him on the show. He's been on this. He was on when I was on WEBY, so he knows me. He's been on the show before. I've had a few Santa Rosa County Sheriff deputies and more lieutenants on as well. And so this, you know, it'd be nice to get him back on. But he's someone, you know, because you're getting law enforcement. Yeah, and law enforcement are the people that are one of the groups that's resisting. But if there's any enforcement of this from a law enforcement point of view, you know, sheriff, you know, is going to be the one to talk to. And also, sheriffs are constitutional officers. Their duty is to the Constitution, not to the government, not to certainly, you know, President Nobody and the communist minions. That's not where he's loyal to. He's loyal to the Constitution, to this county, and to the citizens, to American citizens. And so I think the more we can have, you know, law enforcement join with medical freedom and all the other first responders, and maybe, you know, the airline pilots too, but specifically law enforcement, because the county sheriffs are constitutional officers. That might be a huge asset.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that we should be covering? We'll make sure we get it all.
I think that's all for today.
Okay. Wow. Well, thank you so much. Great report. We'll talk again next Thursday at 6 o'clock. Oh boy, still getting used to the 6 o'clock hour, but it's wonderful. And of course, we're gonna be talking during the week because I'm gonna have a gazillion ideas for you. It's kind of it's my curse. It's my curse in life. Yeah. Any groups, information groups, emails, Facebook pages, any information you want to give so people can learn more about you and the group or about the group?
Yeah, I'd love to give my email address. We do have a fundraiser going for our lawsuit. Unfortunately, can't shorten the URL, but if your listeners would like more information on that or would like to donate, we would love that support. So they can email me at janeadams2d's825@gmail.com. janeadams825@gmail.com.
Yeah. You can leave long emails. It's a podcast. Anybody can listen to it later. You miss this. Well, it'll be, you know, a couple hours from now. You can get it again. But so that works out. Jane Adams, thank you so much. Let's do it again next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now. Wow.
Greg.
She's amazing. Yeah. Jean.
I just want to say thank you to everybody that's stepping up, because it's just being in the medical field and having to, you know, for years I took the flu vaccine, even though I didn't want it. But at that point, I didn't have a choice. I did have a choice. It was that or wearing a mask. And, you know, at that point, I didn't want to wear a mask. And now how ironic, we've been wearing masks for a year and a half. But it can be very emotionally and psychologically difficult when you are not part of, I want to say, the majority or the norm. And so I want to thank those guys for stepping up, standing up, verbalizing, taking action to speak up for their, one, well-being, and two, what they want, and saying, hey, no, we're not going to take this anymore. And thank you. It's a huge step, and it's a start. And I just think it's so sad how this country just, it depends who you are, what you are, depends on whether or not you get the vaccine. And I think that's not right. If they want to mandate the vaccine, then everybody should get it. And who I mean by that, then all of the government should get it, meaning the senators, the Congress people, the people that work in the White House, and not just the military, not just private sector medical people. It's insane. And just speak up, because sooner or later, the truth is going to come out. And people are waking up to Biden's, well, not everybody, that's still going to take a while, but just his incompetencies and just his downright just stupidity of some of the things he says doesn't make sense. And Dr. Fascist, people, you know, more and more people are getting on to him too. I can't tell you how many people do not trust that man for his medical knowledge. And isn't that sad? The person that's supposed to be guiding us during this time.
That's good.
They don't trust him. They don't trust.
Are you kidding? That's wonderful. They don't trust him. Yeah.
Yeah. But it makes me, I mean, it's sad in a way, because you think, okay, they should have our best interests at heart, but this is a wake-up call, people. No, they don't. No, they don't. And don't think they do. They've got ulterior motives for all this stuff.
Yeah. You know, when I think about these people and what they're doing, I think they thought this would be a lot easier. I think they thought they could just dictate to the American people, because that's what they do in other countries, and that people, the Americans would be just like everybody else. They'd knuckle under, they'd do the mask mandates and the vaccines and the lockdowns, and they put up with it, and we would just do as we're told. I really think they believe that. I think they're kind of shocked to find out that the Americans don't want to do that, at least the ones that are, you know, the patriotic Americans, the real Americans, the Trump-supporting Americans, the independent Americans, the mom-and-pop shops, the small family farmers, the people that the elite in Washington never see because they live in a bubble, which is why we need to move the Washington government to, I don't know, Greenland, you know, or scatter them. You know, let's put the Department of Interior in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we'll put the Department of Energy in Phoenix, Arizona, and we'll put we'll get rid of the Education Department. But in other words, I would decentralize the entire government. I would move them everywhere. I would put the Pentagon in Diego Garcia. I guess it's one of our little territories out there in the middle of nowhere. You know, I mean, but because they're all together, all they talk to are people that agree with them. They have no clue. And I think, you know, they're surprised. Go ahead.
They also get sheeple to work for them. I mean, they take anybody, and the people that work for them, who are they? They're people that are incompetent. Look, tell me one person in the current fake administration, what I don't know what you want to call it, that has any competence in their job. Who got those jobs? It's Obama holdouts or people that worked in his administration, since this is Obama, 3.0, whatever it is. And
exactly what
it's
it is,
people
yeah.
that will do whatever they're told. I mean, you just look at the top military leaders, the Secretary of State. I mean, I was listening last night, and this is all over social media.
Mm-hmm.
The father from Landon County in Virginia, you know, you heard about him, correct?
Which one now?
The father from Landon County, who last, I think it was May or June, went and spoke at a school board meeting. His daughter was, I don't know, sexually assaulted. Something happened sexually. And guess
in
who?
In a woman's room, yeah.
Yes. And so who was it? Superintendent of the schools in a meeting after that. Oh, we heard nothing of anything like that going on. I mean, he didn't say this case. He just said, no, there's nothing going on. And now what happened? Supposedly the same student was sent to a different school, and now this, not the same thing happening, but something happened again. And now they're finally getting the truth out. But how sad that this girl, what happened to her doesn't matter. And the only thing that matters is a boy pretending to possibly be a girl so he could do these awful things.
Well,
and then
with
this
guy
in the...
Those are the guys that are doing that. You know, most guys would not want to look in a woman's room. They just wouldn't. But
right. And then if you look at the school board meeting when the cops jumped this guy, you know why? They won't even let him talk. And how sad is that? How sad is that? So kudos for him for continuing to fight and those people there. Now others are standing up, speaking up. I mean, this is sad. We're not talking adults. It's like that when this first happened, that kid should no longer have been allowed to go in. Well, I can't even say he went into the girls' bathroom because supposedly the second girl, it was an empty classroom. Now, I can't say for sure I wasn't there, but that's what I heard from reports.
Yeah.
I mean, how sad. Yeah. You can't even be safe in your own school. And yes, I know, unfortunately, people get shot there. People bring guns to school. Things like that do happen. But with this that happened, okay, who in their right mind should have or would have said that's appropriate? I'm sorry, but if you have a transgender person and I'm all for them, go do whatever you want to do. I don't care. But you know what? Have a bathroom. Just a bathroom. Just walk in, go to the bathroom, get out. You don't have to go to one that's all girl or a girl's bathroom or a boy's bathroom. Go to a single stall bathroom. You know, all you're doing is going to the bathroom. It's not an area where you should be socializing. You don't have time anyway when you're in school because you have to go and then you have to get to class.
No more smoking in the boys' room, as Motley Crue sang about?
Exactly.
Smoking in the boys' room.
You know, but I mean, this girl, I mean, she, both of them have got to be traumatized for what they've been through.
There's an agenda. This is an agenda here because the people that are pushing the fact that there are no genders are encouraging sexual activity. And I think in a way they're encouraging illegal, assaultive, you know, rape, sexual activity that's going to occur there. And that's all part of the plan to desexualize the, in other words, remove the morals, remove the standards, remove any sense of decency, remove anything that makes you an individual. You know, if you can break people down, you know, and remove all sexual barriers, then you can break down pretty much any other barrier. I think this is all part of the whole thing, the communist group think. We're all the same. We're all equal. We all wear the same clothes. We all have the same income. We're all the same. And the more they try and make people the same, especially Americans, which is the point I was getting to earlier, we are still individuals. And there's still that individual spirit.
And
they can bring in
that's what makes us great.
But all the illegals that are coming in, everybody else, ain't going to happen because a certain percentage of those people are going to actually assimilate and want to become Americans the way we are. And then we send them home, and then they apply, and then they can come back. But the others are just making it impossible. Yeah,
talking about the illegals, now I don't know if this is true because I couldn't even read the whole article. I was so disgusted. Supposedly, there's a caravan now of 80,000 people coming towards the border.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, when are they going to say enough is enough?
Well, Democrats never say that because they're in a replacement program. They're replacing Americans with illegal aliens as a voting bloc. That's what this is all about.
Every time Psaki gets on and starts talking about the vax mandate and stuff like that, reporters need to start manning up and saying, hey, what are you going to do about the border? Hey, what are you going to do about the border? You want the vaccine mandates? What are you going to do about the border? No, they're not. They don't because they just turn a blind eye too. They are part of the problem.
No, it's more than that. If you understand the White House press corps, in other words, they are, you have to get called on. If you're a White House press person, first of all, you have to be selected for it. And the White House press corps has their own press selections, like a club. So you got to join the club. And the way you join the club is you help, you know, make the White House press corps look better. And the way you further your career is you get called on. So if you're known for asking really tough questions, you're not going to get called on unless, you know, you used to be a Fox reporter. And then we had one of the Fox reporters, Rosen, was actually investigated by the Obama administration. And so they walk this line where they want to be popular. They want to be liked, you know, by the administration. So they get called on to advance their career. So it's not in their interest to ask questions. The system they have set up now, this is why the White House press corps should be abolished. Just get rid of them all. Because they're absolutely useless. But it reinforces a culture of approving of what Democrat administrations are doing. And because they're all leftists back home at the home office, it reinforces a culture that everything Trump did was wrong and everything Biden does is right. And we know it's just the opposite. Pretty much everything Trump did was right, you know, except when it came to COVID. That was his big downfall. But I guarantee you everything that Biden is doing is wrong. And Obama being behind
Biden
it all.
Well, everything Biden ever did is wrong.
What's that now? Well, yeah,
Everything he's done has been wrong. I mean, you look how he used, well, and I don't know how he still talks now because he can't get a coherent thought out, but how he used to talk about black, I'm not going to have my kids go be, you know, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Kidding? And people think he's just better than sliced bread. It's like, oh my God, I'm so glad people are wising up. A little late, but better late than never. And then what happened with the election, the ballots now in Georgia, the judge threw them out and they're not even going to look into it because whoever didn't prove something. I didn't understand that. I was trying to read this article.
Which case is that? Go for it. What's
the
going
one that was just that just I was just reading about it yesterday that over 144,000 or something votes, something with them, the judges, he said they didn't show merit or something. It's like, well, you didn't even look at it. So I don't know.
So wait a minute. Is he throwing those ballots out saying that they're invalid, or is he saying that they have to be counted?
No, that's what I didn't understand the whole article. He basically said that the lawsuit, whoever brought this lawsuit up, didn't show anything, whatever they were supposed to show. So he's throwing the lawsuit out. So they're not.
All right.
But
send me
the
article. Send me the article.
I don't know if I can find the article again. I probably can't. I look at so many different things. let me see. Because I'm all over the board, and I'm just like, I'm bad because if I get frustrated with it, if it's like, oh my God, this is so asinine, I can't even finish reading it because I can't. And then it's like, oh, let me see if Let me see.
Now,
if
listen,
I can
there
it.
Are millions of people that are exactly in your position, and so you represent a whole lot of folks. So if you're frustrated, they're frustrated. I'll see if I can sort it out. My guess, if I had to make a guess, that this is probably a liberal judge who said there isn't enough fraud to overturn the results. Therefore, we don't have to consider the lawsuit. That's probably, I'm just a guess. I don't know.
Okay. That would make sense, but
that's where I'm going lines. Now, of course, that's a lot of BS because that would be like saying you didn't rob enough money from the bank to put them out of business. Therefore, it's not a crime. Okay. That's my analogy. And, and of course it doesn't matter. You know, if you steal, $1 from a 7-Eleven, it's the same as stealing $1,000 from a 7-Eleven. You're still a thief. Okay. There's grand larceny and petty larceny, but it's still larceny. You know, there's vote fraud, there's grand vote fraud, and there's smaller vote fraud. There's vote fraud that overturns the results, and there's vote fraud that doesn't overturn the results. It doesn't matter. It's still vote fraud. You should still be disqualified for vote fraud because the fact that you're unsuccessful, it's like attempted murder, still carries the same penalty as a murder. The fact that you didn't succeed is wonderful, but it doesn't make the charge any less because the intent is the same. So in the same way, vote fraud, regardless of how successful you are with your vote fraud, you don't have to be successful to make it a crime. The fact that you engage in it at all makes it a crime, and your candidate should be disqualified. That's why I'm not in favor of decertification in Arizona, although decertification is a good thing. It's better than not decertifying, but it's nowhere near as good as disqualifying. And so the results of the audit should be disqualification. The Attorney General and the state legislature of Arizona should disqualify Joe Biden. They should cancel those Biden electors, and they should replace them with Trump electors. That's what they should do. Now, whether they're going to or not, I don't know. Decertification is almost as good because at least it removes Biden electors, and then it would throw it to the House of Representatives, which would be Republican, which would be Trump, simply because, that's the way it goes. But in the overall grand scheme of things, I'm wondering now. I'm thinking, we're a year from 2022, okay? We're a year into the Trump campaign run by Joe Biden, honorary chairman. I posted that on Facebook today. There is no greater vote-getter for Trump than Joe Biden. I was joking about this morning, but Trump, if I could talk to Donald Trump. So Donald Trump, if your folks are listening, okay, you should be calling us here on a regular basis because we have the best ideas in the country. You should be doing that. And my idea for this morning is to name Joe Biden the honorary chair of the Trump 2024 campaign. First of all, piss off the left no end. But secondly, it's true. Nobody's going to get more votes for Trump than Biden. This just, in kind of a weird way, it's the audit should be pursued because they need to change the election laws and they need to remove COVID as an excuse for mail-in ballots. But the other effect of this is the longer Biden stays there, and if Harris gets there, it's even going to be accelerated more because she's worse than he is. She's bizarre, hiring a bunch of kid actors to talk about how she knows about space all of a sudden. Well, the only space she knows about is the one between her ears, so she's if they actually name her, usurped president, who's she going to sleep with to get her information?
That's what happens when that's what you do to get ahead. You're clueless. Yeah. Well, yeah. clueless in what you're supposed to be doing, except the powers that be don't care because they're only interested in one thing. But then there's another thing that I've been reading in the documents from the internal Capitol Police about January 6th and the Ashy Bobbitt shooting. And it revealed that there was no good reason for the shooting. Okay, so is this cop going to be charged?
That would be Lieutenant Michael J. Byrd. Lieutenant Michael J. Byrd.
How he was so afraid of his life. It's like, are you, I mean, are all these people so afraid of their life? I'm sorry, what happened last year? Black Lives Matter was going on in D.C.
Yeah.
Were you afraid of your life then? There were a lot more thugs. These guys that you let in that were doing what they were doing, a lot of them, they weren't even Trump supporters. Those guys were just walking around. It's crazy.
Well, a lot of them was Antifa and Black Lives
Matter.
I mean, it was an organized, organized coup.
And the FBI.
So,
and what do we hear about that? Supposedly the FBI was involved in January 6th.
Slow down. You're talking faster than I do, and that's hard to do. let me just hold you up for a little bit here, because I want to make it really clear that Lieutenant Michael J. Byrd is the person that assassinated Ashley Babbitt. It's on camera. Everybody knows it. He's being hidden. So the what you want to think about is, why is he being hidden? Well, he's being hidden because if he gets out in the public, you know, the truth will be found out that, you know, I don't think he did it intentionally necessarily. I don't think it was premeditated. I think he's just an insanely bad officer. He's terrible at what he does. And the fact that they're guarding him makes all those people accessories. So that needs to come out, because you really need to find out. And if you get that, you'll get the coup. You'll get the organizers of the coup. You'll get the Democrats and the Republicans that organized that whole effort. Because he'll sing like a canary to protect his own sorry ass. You know, so you need to put him on the stand and say, well, who told you to, you know, who prepared you for this? Who organized this? Who's behind all this? Because we know it's a deep state operation to stop the election challenge. That's what January 6th was all about. Okay, it has nothing to do with a Trump insurrection. There was no Trump insurrection. What, a bunch of people walking around, you know, unorganized, just people randomly taking selfies? That's your insurrection? Oh, please. Now, so we cover the Capitol Hill police. I want to know, in fact, I should talk to Jane about this, whether, you know, we can get some doctors investigating whether Brian Sicknick, you know, died of a COVID vaccine. That's what I think, because he had two strokes. That would blow the lid off a lot of this, too. You know, so that we need to find out. But you made a point about the FBI. Tell me what you're thinking as far as the FBI's involvement here. What's going on?
Oh, they were saying that something I read last week, that there was talk, and I don't know if there's actual proof, but I mean, talk is cheap, but about FBI people that were actually infiltrated into it and or knew what was going on and just allow, you know, continued with the narrative that,
they're absolutely.
And how sad is that? And
because
you kind of figured that just because of how it is. But what is, are they still investigating January 6th in Washington, or did they finally drop that because they couldn't get enough people interested in it? When, who was it, what organization came out, last month or the month before saying that there was no insurrection, that it, Trump did not do it? Where everybody's like, oh, it was Trump. And they're like, no, he did not.
No, the FBI, somebody in the FBI, someone in the justice found that they, because there were no weapons found. There was no organized plan. There was no insurrection because there was no insurrection. You can't prove an insurrection when one doesn't exist. You can't make it up. And that was just a political line to try and demonize Trump supporters. And here's what's going on, too. There's a judge, Royce Lambert, I believe is his name. And he's been a good judge before. So Royce Lambert just found the D.C. head of corrections and the warden at the D.C. jail, the people that are making political prisoners out of the January 6th Trump supporters. He just found contempt of court with both of those people. Okay.
Good.
So things is very good. Things is, Royce Lambert's one of the good guys. So things are starting to happen. And he's been in cases before. So I want to do a little I'm going to write this down. Judge Royce
Lambert. But you want to give a round of applause? He deserves it. These people, some of them, aren't they still in jail? For what
did
they do?
Most of them are in jail.
It's
all in jail.
How could they be still kept in jail? I mean, that's crazy. So they're found guilty before they're even charged.
Thanks, Judge. Nice job.
I feel bad for those people. Some of them that, you know, are just there.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. And how many people have lost their jobs just because they were there? It's like, oh, my gosh, how sad. But I'm just seeing this in Marjorie Taylor Greene's Instagram. This isn't the article, but it's Fulton County audit case dismissed on lack of standing. And It happened on, well, God, that happened a while ago. What are we talking about? It happened on August 12th.
Yeah, that's old news at this point. Things are happening so fast. Yeah. Let me hold you up a little bit here because I have a feeling that once we get John Cullen on, he's going to take the hour plus maybe, and we're going to have Claire Lopez joining us, and we're going to get from unbelievable statistics on COVID, things like the resurrection of the Spanish flu, the fact that influenza was the real culprit here that's being covered up. There's some massive things that John's revealed. He's the one we tried to get on last week. And so we're going to bring him on in a little bit. And then it might extend, I don't know how much time we'll have between him and Claire. I mean, you never know. And so I want to play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece right now. And we'll do that. We've got about 9 minutes before John joins us. So let's hold up right now. Hold that story. We can bring it up again. We've got tomorrow. We've got the next day. We've got, isn't it nice being producer so you can bring up the stuff every day? It's kind of cool. All right, let me play this right now. And then we'll be back in a few minutes. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. The pompous, arrogant, elitist John Jay, who wrote Federalist Paper No. 5, has such complete contempt for the American people that he obviously wants to rule over the people for their own good with his strong national constitution. However, the rebuttal in Anti-Federalist No. 5 is just the opposite. It is simple, short, honest, straightforward, takes John Jay's writing head on, and makes complete hash of John Jay's weak propaganda. Anti-Federalist No. 5 was written and signed by an anonymous author known only as An Observer. Whoever it is appeals to my sense of logic and reason to take on the elitist and powerful through quiet ridicule where you are making total fun of them, but it's not so obviously apparent to them. This is probably the easiest of my discussions of any founding document because all I have to do is mention some select quotes to show you how An Observer turns John Jay's writing into mush. John Jay began Federalist No. 5 with the claim that the union of Scotland and England should be the model of our states, and that a letter from Queen Anne to the Scotch Parliament would be the convincing evidence. An Observer writes, "It is a certainty that when the union was the subject of debate in the Scottish legislature, some of their most sensible and disinterested nobles, as well as commoners, who were not corrupted by English gold, violently opposed the union and predicted that the people of Scotland would, in fact, derive no advantages from a consolidation of government with England, but on the contrary, they would bear a great proportion of her debt and furnish large bodies of men to assist in her wars with France, with whom, before the Union, Scotland was at all times on terms of the most cordial amity." It appears quite clear that the Union envisioned by John Jay is based on force and subjugation. No wonder John Jay became our first Supreme Court Chief Justice. The elites were already moving in shortly after the ratification of the Constitution. An Observer further observes, "It deserves also to be remembered that the people of Scotland, in the late war between France and Great Britain, petitioned to have arms and ammunition supplied them by their general government for their defense, alleging that they were incapable of defending themselves and their property from an invasion unless they were assisted by government. It is a truth that their petitions were disregarded, and reasons were assigned that it would be dangerous to entrust them with the means of defense, as they would then have it in their power to break the Union." This definitely portends a future U.S. where the government would have all the arms and the people defenseless, all in order that the national government remain in power. In describing this absurd example in Federalist No. 5, An Observer states, "From this representation of the situation of Scotland, surely no one can draw any conclusion that this country would derive happiness or security from a government which would, in reality, give the people but the mere name of being free." The last paragraph of Anti-Federalist Number 5 is so good, there is no explanation that is needed, so let me close with this from An Observer. I observe that the writer above mentioned takes great pains to show the disadvantages which would result from 3 or 4 distinct confederacies of these states. I must confess that I have not seen in any of the pieces published against the proposed Constitution anything which gives the most distant idea that their writers are in favor of such governments. But it is clear these objections arise from a consolidation not affording security for the liberties of their country, and from hence it must evidently appear that the design of Publius in artfully holding up to public view the bugbear of such confederacies can be with no other intention than willfully to deceive his fellow citizens. Publius is what John Jay called himself in the Federalist Papers. Going on, I am confident it must be, and that it is, the sincere wish of every true friend to the United States that there should be a confederated national government, but that it should be one which would have a control over national and external matters only, and not interfere with the internal regulations and police of the different states in the Union. Such a government, while it would give us respectability abroad, would not encroach upon or subvert our liberties at home. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from foundingfathersquotes.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can be trusted as much as personal recommendations from family and friends. You can increase foot and website traffic. You can do all this, all without paying Google, Facebook, or Instagram one red cent. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. That's besmallbusiness.com. BESMALLBUSINESS. besmallbusiness.com. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it. Too much stuff I was doing there. Okay, let's make my mic back active. We're still working on our Skype. This is going to be our first guest with Skype. It looks like everything's working. I think I didn't see a place to officially acknowledge the invite. This has been a really big technical problem, and we've done a lot of work, especially with the person in London. We had a person do that. Let me just check the line here and make sure this is all working. If it's working, you know, this has been my big concern all day long. John Cullen, are you there? Can you hear me? Is everything – are we working?
Hello, Greg.
Ah, there we go.
I hear you.
That's what I wanted to hear. Gene, you got him too? Everything's working great? Because this was just an amazing. What this means is we can take calls.
Yes, it's okay, perfect. Good.
What this means, John, now, is, and for everybody listening, we can take calls from all over the world. You know, we've been heard in over 70 countries. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I was going to note that Russia is now our fourth biggest audience outside the United States. Most people are still, you know, it's well over 90% American, but we do have listeners in Canada, Australia, and England, Israel, Germany are like the usual places. But all of a sudden, Russia showed up as the number fourth place. So they're listening to us over there. So, hey, Vladimir, hey, how you doing? We're having a good time over here. It's a good time. All right. Anyway, don't mind me. I have my fun. So you're a fascinating person. I've been listening to your information. I've been reading it, you know, the videos that you do. And so, first of all, let me apologize for last week's complications, but let's dig into this week. We've got the whole hour. Actually, we might even have a few more minutes, depending on how long you can and want to stick around here. But people don't think are familiar with you. And that includes me a little bit. I looked you up and I got a hockey player. So I think, yeah, that's probably not you. But if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to get this incredible knowledge that you seem uniquely qualified now to talk about that not a whole lot of folks have. So let's go with that, and then we'll get to, you know, the questions. And again, you're free to present whichever, you know, topics you want. I'm open. You know what you want to talk about, and I just want to let you go and just, you know, do your thing. Sir, good morning.
Sure. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. By way of introduction, I started publishing content on YouTube a couple of years ago, and as an investigative journalist, my background is in IT, and I was semi-retired, living overseas, and in October of 2017, I happened to catch the Las Vegas shooting as it was happening live, because 10 p.m. in Las Vegas was noon where I was. And so I was able to kind of follow what was happening in real time between, you know, Facebook and Twitter and what have you, and then eventually television. But I was able to sort of keep an eye on it. And I discovered things about the Las Vegas shooting that were inconsistent with the narrative, and eventually started to publish content on YouTube and became a bit of, I guess, an underground sensation, you might say. You know, so very few people knew about it, but the people who did know about my content were rather vociferous about it and, became sort of big fans.
I hear you get quite a following building up that way, which is wonderful. That's how the information gets out there. You know, you have to reach a certain
So one of the things that's strange,
critical mass. Yeah.
One of the things that's strange. The channel that I have on YouTube is not John Cullen. So the channel on YouTube was originally but it was struck within 30 days of me setting it up, and so I had to set up a second channel. So I set up a second channel, and in the moment, I didn't give it that much thought. And so I said, all right, I want to do some sort of a double entendre, alternate universe type of thing. And so I looked up J. Edgar Hoover's real name, and J. Edgar Hoover's real name is John. It's John Edgar Hoover. And so in an alternate universe, the FBI would actually tell you what they were doing and would tell you about their investigations and would share with you how they do it and what they did this week, and here's what we found and here's what we discovered and here's the evidence that points to this. That's not what happens. The FBI lies to the public, and now recently the government has said, oh yeah, we've been lying about the extraterrestrial stuff for about 75 years, but never mind, you don't need to know too much more about that other than it's kind of real. So they, they just cover stuff up and they just lie about it, and then they tell you they're lying about it, and then they just keep lying about it. So this alternate universe channel I named John E. Hoover, which is J. Edgar Hoover's alternate name. So the name of the channel on YouTube is John E. Hoover, and I start publishing all of this content on the John E. Hoover channel. And it's basically narrative breaking content based on evidence, not opinion. So it's not opinion journalism. It's evidence-based journalism. And then I started to do a show on Fridays with Jason Goodman at Crowdsource the Truth. And that's where we would get into opinion-based journalism. That's where we would look at the evidence, and as two adult men, we would discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, what do you think about this? Do you see what I see? Do you hear what I hear?
Yeah.
You know, is this causing cognitive dissonance for you like it is for me? And we'd have those conversations. And that's where we started getting into opinion-based journalism with Jason. And then via Jason, I met Larry Klayman. And many of you may know Larry Klayman.
He's been on the show.
The attorney who... Well, he's been on your show. He's the attorney that represented Clive and Bundy and the Bundy family. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a well-known attorney. And Larry asked me to testify at his citizens grand jury about Anthony Fauci. And when I came to the citizens grand jury with all of this data from the CDC and from the Johns Hopkins mapping system, I think Larry was a bit stunned, as was the citizens jury, the grand jury, in seeing that the data was right there. You know, there's no conspiracy theory. The data's right in front of you. I mean, there's no hacking required. All the data's perfectly available. You don't need a secret code to get to it. And it's right in front of you.
Yeah.
And in looking at the data doesn't support the narrative. And so I started to publish, well, basically Jason Goodman said to me, I think there's something more to this pandemic that meets the eye. Can you dig into this a little bit? And I'm like, well, I don't know anything about viruses. And, what am I going to find here? And so lo and behold, I start poking around. I'm looking at stuff. And what I realized was that the mapping system that they were using on television was the one that I built 30 years ago. And that was just a coincidence.
Let's explain that a little bit. When you say a mapping system, what did you build? Because this is, you know, I'm kind of a details person, and I don't want to get swamped in them. But this is interesting to me. What did you build? How are they using it? Why are they using it? Why wasn't your name all over to get credit for it, or have they misused it? What's the story of this? I'm curious.
All right. So, 30-something years ago, I worked at Oracle, and when I was working at Oracle for Larry Ellison. There was a company in Redlands, California that had this technology and a vision that they wanted to marry data and maps.
Okay.
And 30-something years ago, so this was in the 80s, all right? So 30-something years ago, all of us at Oracle were looking at them like, what do you want to do? What? You want to marry the data and the map?
Yeah.
What the why and how and where are you going with this? But they had a real operation, and they had, you know, they had an office and some smart people, and they were willing to spend some money. And so the more meetings we had with them, the more we kept booking each other. You know, this is kind of interesting. You know, this this thing could fly. You know, this could work out. And so ultimately, I pulled together a team of people, which is, you know, what you do, and we married the Oracle database and their mapping technology. And they are the pioneers with this of something called geographic information systems. Isn't that
interesting?
For it is the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason that my name isn't associated with it is the same reason that you don't know who it was that was the project manager that helped put together Photoshop. And you don't know who the project manager was who helped put together PowerPoint. People like us don't, there is no Hall of Fame for, you know, the project manager who built PowerPoint. Right?
Interesting.
But
yeah,
everybody
we just assume
uses PowerPoint.
It's just there. Yeah, I know who did email, Dr. Shiva, but he's like the only person I know of those technologies that we use all the time and take for granted. He's the one that stands out for some reason. You know, you creating this map with these people does not.
I didn't patent anything. I was just a guy at Oracle that went out there and led the team.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. And so all the whiteboard meetings and all that kind of stuff, I was the meeting facilitator, so to speak.
Okay.
Project manager, program manager. All right. So when I saw the Johns Hopkins was using you know, my baby. This was one of my first projects at Oracle. So it would be like if your first car from when you were 17
mm-hmm.
happened to play a key role in some key crime, and then you're like, wait a second, that's my first car.
That's my 65 Volkswagen.
Like
what's it doing
my
there?
First car. That is my first car.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
That's my car.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at the software and I'm saying, what are you doing? It took me 5 minutes. I mean, I didn't
doing?
Even think it took 5 minutes. I think less than 3 minutes.
Okay.
I took one look at it. So now let me explain to the audience where they can find the software, first of all.
Yeah,
so
take your time.
We
got plenty
about.
Of time to talk about this stuff. So this is absolutely fascinating. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, so on TV, you see all the newscasters talking about the pandemic, and I'm talking about the early days. I'm talking about March of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in March of 2020, they're presenting to you this thing that's coming from China, et cetera.
Right.
The map can be found if you go to Drudge Report. Most people know drudgereport.com. It's
mm-hmm.
pretty highly rated, right? So if you go to drudgereport.com and you go to the web-based version for PCs, not the mobile version. The mobile version is like one long column. I don't know how to tell you to navigate that. But if you go to the one that you would use on a computer, it's
mm-hmm.
three columns of reporting Drudge. The
right.
middle column, the bottom item before they get to all the writers, says World Sick Map. And it has said World Sick Map there for over a year and a half now.
That's just, I see.
All you need to do is click on that. All right? And if you click on World Sick Map, mm-hmm. that's the map.
Oh, SICK, the
Johns
Hopkins World Sick Map.
System.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Got it.
All right, so that's how you can get there. So for the audience, you go to drudgereport.com, you go to the middle column, go to the bottom of the content in the middle column, and you'll see World Sick Map. You click on that,
mm-hmm.
and then bookmark that when you get there. That's the Johns Hopkins official map. And
right.
this mapping system, the underlying architecture of it, was something that I helped put this whole thing together 30-something years ago.
Okay, this
so,
is what you just sent me before the show, right? Total cases, 108,000. Total deaths, 4,800. Total vaccine doses administered, 2,225,504. 2,225,504,000. That's the map you're talking about?
That's right. So that
okay.
So when I say I helped put this together, what I mean is 30-something years ago, the underlying
right.
software, like the
okay.
Photoshop or the PowerPoint part,
mm-hmm.
now other people come along and they use those tools to create what you're looking at, which is now an iteration of it, like a PowerPoint presentation or a Photoshopped image. So now you're looking at somebody's work. What was interesting that I didn't know a year and a half ago, but I did discover in the last, I don't know, 3 to 6 months,
mm-hmm.
was that the person who was configuring the map at Johns Hopkins was a Chinese national.
Oh, boy. Alarm bells are going off, yeah. See, now I've used that map. I mean, I've got involved with this back at the end of February. I was lucky enough to get Bill Gertz on the show February, I think, 25th of 2020. We talked about the Wuhan lab, you know, light years before anybody else. He wrote articles about it, and I got intrigued, and I had a connection that knew Bill. And those articles got scrubbed a few months later, but now I think they'd be back, and I'm not sure. But it was March 2nd of 2020, I may have talked to you about this, I don't know, that I broke the story on Action Radio that Dr. Didier Raoult over in Marseille, France, had done studies that chloroquine kills COVID. And as soon as I found that out, and then I got and I heard about Dr. Zelenko, and he's now a friend of the show. In fact, he just texted me this morning. I got to get in touch with him too. But I knew, and everybody involved in Action Radio knew, in March of 2020 that this entire government response was a total farce. It was a total hoax. We knew it cured COVID, and I did a show. In fact, you can probably, maybe we can talk about this, in detail another time, but I found viruses that kill viruses. And I spent like an afternoon just looking this up. It's just me. I'm just casually looking up. Mm-hmm. Well, let me see. And do what you did. You just start looking around and poking around. How does this work? So I found viruses that kill viruses. I found viruses that work with drugs to kill viruses. I found particular drugs that kill viruses. I found that there are drugs that act like a laser, targeting sites that really help viruses kill other viruses, and all these things. Mm-hmm. I found like several different ways to kill viruses, none of which was a vaccine. I don't want to get ahead of the story, but the point was that nobody was looking at any of the things that I was talking about until now, like a year, year and a half, year and three quarters later. But, you know, you're on the front lines. I was on the front lines. Dr. Zelenka was on the front lines. Dr. Raul was on the front lines. All these folks, the information was there. Like you say, it was there. We weren't hiding it. In fact, we were broadcasting as loud as we could. But the story wasn't getting out because the oppressive part of the story was so big and so loud. And then you had big tech suppressing so much of what we were trying to say, you know, in our different expertise areas, that it got drowned out. Only now is it starting to come out, which is quite fascinating. Like I said, I didn't even know about you till a few months ago, because I know Jonathan Mosley, who's our legal person who works with Larry Klayman, and that's how you came to be here. So we're one big happy family of activists in our respective areas.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to you.
Well, I think that many people have been trying to figure out, why is there so much cognitive dissonance around it? Why is there so much that doesn't add up?
Right.
Right. So why would they not want to talk about hydroxy? Why would they not want to talk about ivermectin? Mm-hmm. Why would that be? Right. So if it is effective and Dr. Didier has, why would you not want to hear that?
Mm-hmm.
That was the cognitive dissonance that I think made everybody who wanted to start to investigate started investigating it.
Mm-hmm.
What I discovered, though, was something far scarier than anybody you've mentioned has realized. All right. And that's really, I sent you an email with two clips from the map that I took just before we went live on the show.
Right.
And I'm going to drop a couple bombs on your audience right now that is going to give them goosebumps.
That's what we're here for. So,
all right.
Yeah.
All right, so the terminology that's been thrown around is that it's either the China virus or the CCP virus or the Wuhan virus. Then all of a sudden, Fauci starts getting in all this trouble that, well, maybe we kind of funded some of it. Maybe, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. What was it about the map that caused me to say, whoa, what are you doing?
Yeah. What was it about the map?
What was it?
We call him Dr. Fascist, by the way. It's Dr. Fascist, the genocidal psychopathic drug pusher. That's what we call him. So
you have no idea.
You're among friends.
No,
yeah.
No, you really don't know. You don't know how bad it is. Don't know how bad it is.
Hmm.
All right. Today, as you sit here, as the audience listens to this right now, there aren't 10 people dead in Beijing from coronavirus. And there aren't 10 people dead in Shanghai from coronavirus. The only city in China that has more than 500 people dead or more than 1,000 dead is Wuhan. So if the capital city doesn't have 10 dead, and Shanghai, which is the most populated city with a population of 24.5 million people, doesn't have 10 people dead, according to Johns Hopkins and the World Health Organization, why didn't Anderson Cooper think that was important to bring up?
I mean, that's a staggering statistic. You know, I've heard it before. I'm looking at this and I look at
where
the map and I can
before?
See it right there.
I'm going to challenge you.
I think it was your video. I mean, like I said, because I get so many information sources. That'd be the, as I recall. But I remember this just jumps out of my head that somewhere along the line, I pretty much guarantee it was one of your sources. It was you. But that there were so few that there's something really totally misinformed going on here. And this is why I wanted you really on the show, and I wanted to give you the time to really explain this in detail as to what's going on. So of course, the next question
is
why.
That was the impetus.
Okay.
Right, so that was the impetus. I'm looking
at
the
map. You
saw
it on the map, right? You just saw it on the map. You're just reading it. How did that come about? You just looked at it on the map and there it was, 10 dead.
Look at the pictures I just sent you. I sent you one of Beijing and one of Shanghai. And one says 9 and one says 7.
Yep.
All right. So I'm looking at it and I'm saying, and back then there weren't 5 dead. There weren't 5 people dead in Shanghai or Beijing or Hong Kong back then. Now I think Hong Kong is at 515 or something. But if New York has 25 or 30,000 people dead, how does Shanghai have 10, less than 10? Well, back then, the issue was how the map and the system was built. It was portraying Beijing and Shanghai as red. And it was portraying Vietnam as red. And it was portraying Laos as red. And it was portraying Cambodia as red. And I'm going, well what do you got to do to earn a green around here? So there's nobody dead. There's nobody dead in Vietnam, and there's nobody dead in Cambodia, and there's nobody dead in Laos, but you've got red dots there? Who built this? Well, the guy who
Photoshop
built it,
earlier.
His name is Enfeng Dong. His name is Enfeng Dong.
Can you spell
and
that?
Enfeng Dong is a Chinese national who works at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health for Dr. Warren Gardner. I've done videos on all this. You find this at the Johnny Hoover channel on YouTube.
Okay.
So all this is documented in my videos and on the interview show that I do with Jason on Friday nights. That's our live stream things. And that's all there on the same channel. So Enfeng Dong, the Chinese national, configures my mapping system where everything is red, regardless of status. Why would you do that?
I've got my.
Why would you
I've
put that on television?
So
he's a 20-something-year-old kid. Let's assume he made a mistake. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. But John King puts that on television? On CNN? He doesn't know better?
Well, they don't check the sources.
There's
my
not
10
people dead. There's not 10 people dead in Shanghai. There's not 10 people dead in Beijing. There's not 5,000 people dead in China. There's more people dead in Arkansas than China. And you're going to call it the China virus? And you're going to talk to me about Wuhan?
Yeah.
No. You guys all got fooled. You all got conned. And Dr. Fauci has a tell. And Dr. Fauci and his ego let it slip. And in Georgetown in 2017.
Yep.
10 days before the inauguration, Dr. Fauci predicts a surprise outbreak. But the virus that he predicts wasn't SARS-CoV-2. That's not the outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so SARS-CoV-2 has a role here, and it's real. And that's another thing that drives me crazy is people think it's not real. It is real.
Yeah.
Right? And
no, I believe
and
it's
people
real.
Think it hasn't been isolated.
It's been isolated.
Yeah. It's isolated every day. It's being isolated every day. All right, but here's the thing. What I realized when I saw the map and everything was red and Laos was red and Cambodia was red and Vietnam was red, nobody was dead. So I said, well, wait a second. Let's do some baselining. And baselining is, you know, where we go and look at, well, what was it like before COVID? How many people were dying? How many people, you know, what was going on here? Let's look at other respiratory infections. So I started to study tuberculosis, and I found out that 3,300 people die every day from tuberculosis around the world.
Wow.
3,300 people a day die from tuberculosis. 550 people die every day from norovirus, which is when
I've
you get sick on a cruise ship and you're puking your guts up. Oh, my God, it's ruthless. I've had it a couple of times. I mean, it feels like you've got an animal inside you. Oh, ruthless.
Yeah.
550 people a day die from norovirus. All right, so I'm learning all this stuff early on, and then I stumble. I mean, I literally, you know, the old saying, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yep.
Well, if you work 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, eventually you stumble into something, right? So I stumbled into the CDC's data from coroners in a system called Wonder. All right? So I stumble into the Wonder system, and Wonder is this massive database, and I'm an ex-Oracle guy. All right? So I'm right.
So you understand this stuff. Yeah.
So So I go into to Wonder. And I start querying Wonder to find out how many people have died from the various respiratory infections over the course of the last N years that they've got data for.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered was wild. And this was a conversation that Dr. Judy Mikovits and I got into, which is where she educated me about influenza burden, which is a construct that the CDC came up with after the H1N1 outbreak of 2009. So we had the swine flu outbreak of 2009, which was an H1N1 outbreak. And then they came up with this thing called influenza burden. an influenza burden is this complicated formula for how many people died of influenza. But it's not how many people died of influenza. It factors in hospital visits and hospital stays and beds and all kinds of other things to give you like a factor. But they don't make that clear, and they make it sound like it's how many people died. But it's not.
Is that a comorbidity?
And when you go to the
is that how they're describing it? Not really.
Well,
maybe?
I did a video on it where I read their explanation on how do they do it and what.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience's comments, when you go to my videos and you read the comments, you get to see, you know, what does America really think? What does the world think? Like, I've got people all over the world watching this stuff. And people are just, you know, this is buffoonery. What are they doing? Why are they trying to hide the fact? So what I found was a mortality database that was being populated by coroners and medical examiners, not physicians. Not physicians, meaning... this data is dead people.
Right.
Yeah, good.
Well, what I want to make the point, I did a study. We did a show on was Brian Sicknick, the officer who was killed, who died shortly after the January 6th, you know, Capitol Hill walk-in, as I call it. Did he die of a COVID vaccine? And what I found out was that coroners are notoriously underqualified. They're not necessarily even doctors. That there's, especially the D.C. coroner, who has a long history of just horrendously bad reports and things like that. So I'm curious what you think of coroners. Have you found the same thing that I discovered in my wanderings?
Well, this is all death certificate data, right? So many of the death certificates are filled out by the physicians, then validated by medical examiners and coroners after the fact. So this is, again, this isn't an estimate. It's from death certificates, right? So this is a count, not an estimate. And what I found was that the number of people who were dying from influenza, which the CDC, by the way, lumps together with pneumonia because influenza triggers pneumonia and you typically die from the pneumonia. So they call it P and I, pneumonia and influenza. All right. So that's how they call it. It's not my terminology. It's theirs.
Right.
And they don't break them apart. So I've got Dr. Fauci on video with PBS saying that in the 2017-2018 season, 80,000 people died from PNI.
What was that again?
The real number was more like
this down.
In 2017 to 2018. So the seasons begin October 1st. So we just began the season 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And it goes all the way through to September 30th the next year. And the week that is October 1st, they call that week 40. All right, so that's the beginning of flu season.
Okay.
So the flu season that just ended, September 30th, 2 weeks ago, in the United States, had over 400,000 people die. Now, that's unprecedented. That is in the last 100 years. The previous season that had the most was last season with 274. And if you add 274 to 410, you get pretty close to 700,000 people have died from influenza. All right, so now we go to comorbidities, and then we look at comorbidities on COVID. What the CDC tells us is that 95% of the 700,000 COVID deaths had four comorbidities on average. Now, four is the average. That means that for everybody who had two comorbidities, somebody had six.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we've reported this figure
the
before.
Average.
I thought it was 94%, it's 95%. Right. It's the same thing, but it's basically, the difference between dying from COVID and dying with COVID is how I explained it. Is that pretty accurate?
Right. And then, so then you start to dig into, are there differences by sex? And the answer is yes. Twice as many men are dying as women in almost every single age group. Almost every age group, the number of men. There's doctors who've talked about the effect of testosterone and testosterone blockers and stuff, and they said that there's actually a connection between male pattern baldness and susceptibility. because of male pattern baldness is some sort of testosterone blocker or something. I don't know.
Really?
And that they think there's, I read it again. I don't know if it's, you know, if, okay. if there's meat
you
on the
speculate.
Bone there, but it was a theory.
Yeah.
Right. But,
okay.
but we do know that the numbers are roughly twice as many men are dying as women in just about every age group. I mean, not little kids and not 85 and older, because 85 and older, the population in the United States is twice as many women as men. So the population is twice as big. But in every other population group, all right, now the other big statistic most people in the United States don't realize, of the 700,000 people, how many were younger than 45? Give me a hard number.
Very low.
How many people, all right, younger than 45, of the 700,000 people?
Yeah.
No, we're talking about COVID. So when you break the COVID numbers down, they don't hold water, meaning they're telling you 700,000 people are dead. All right. How many of them are younger than 45? Less than 30,000.
Okay.
So less than 30,000 of those people are younger than 45. And of those less than 30,000 people, 95% of them have four comorbidities on average, and only 5% of them died with just COVID-19 on the death certificate.
Just so that's 5% of the 5%.
According
so
the, to the CDC.
Yeah, so if you have 5% of the total people
died. 5% of the 30,000.
From COVID,
right.
5%
of
5% that
of 30,000.
Were under 45.
Right. Wow. So that's a, right. So of the under 45 group of 30,000, about 1,500 people died of SARS-CoV-2. The rest of them had all kinds of other problems. And then we look at, well, what was the number one comorbidity? What's the top of all the people who died with COVID? So 95% of them had at least one comorbidity. What was the number one comorbidity? What's the most popular comorbidity? Influenza.
I remember for this from your videos.
Now, have you heard the clip of Fauci predicting this at Georgetown? Has the audience heard that? I have it queued up if you want to hear it.
Well, I played it a bunch of – well, see, I can only play some of YouTube things. Yeah, go ahead and play it. If you've got it, feel free.
This is just Fauci speaking at Georgetown. It's not YouTube. This is not a YouTube clip. This is Fauci speaking at Georgetown University.
The idea that we are now a few days away from a new administration, the topic today is the issue of pandemic preparedness. And if there's one message that I want to leave with you today based on my experience, and you'll see that in a moment, is that there is no question that there will be a challenge the coming administration in the arena of infectious diseases, both chronic infectious diseases in the sense of already ongoing disease, and we have certainly a large burden of that, but also there will be a surprise outbreak.
So there you go. I mean, how do you predict a surprise outbreak?
Unless you know it's coming. Well, we did I did a bunch of shows actually back in March. All right, go ahead, then I'll tell you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so here's sort of the net of it is, I'm looking at the map. There's nobody dead in Shanghai. There's nobody dead in Beijing. There's nobody dead in Vietnam. There's nobody dead in Laos. And these are countries that border China. There's nobody dead in Mongolia.
And this is COVID specifically, right? This is a COVID map, so people know
this
that we're
right, COVID.
Okay.
That's it, COVID, right? So there's nobody dead of COVID. Then I go to the CDC system, and it shows me there's 4,000 people a week dying of influenza in the United States as of January 1. And I'm, whoa, 4,000 people a week are dying of influenza.
What year is that?
Every week? January 2020,
okay. Gee, that's about when COVID came to the United States, wasn't it? Allegedly.
So before
the end of January.
COVID arrived.
Right. People were already dying.
Before COVID arrived, they were ranting and raving about influenza and how this was the worst season we'd ever seen. And then what happened? And then the new kid moves in and gets all the attention. Now, why would that be? Why would that happen? Well, I'm going to tell you why. In 2005, Dr. Fauci funded, well, actually funded a little bit earlier, but in 2005, they published all their results. Dr. Fauci funded a project that Sports Illustrated wrote about where they went to Alaska to dig up the H1N1 Spanish flu from 1918. They found people that died from it that were buried in permafrost. And a guy by the name of Johann Holten went to Alaska, funded by Fauci, and brought back lung tissue from a deceased woman buried in permafrost. They're able to sequence the gene. And then Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberger, working at Walter Reed for the U.S. government, with a woman named Ann Reed, are able to completely sequence the H1N1 Spanish flu genome. And Science Magazine says, we're only going to publish the story if you put the genome in the public domain. So they did. And they published the Spanish flu genome on GenBank. And what that meant was that anybody who has a gene synthesizer, which is the opposite of a gene sequencer looks at the material and figures out what the DNA is, and then a DNA synthesizer is the thing that clones puppies. So if you want to get a clone of your dog, that's the gene synthesizer, right? So that's the thing that builds stuff based on instructions. It's like a printer, basically.
So wait a minute. No, I want to throw this in really quickly because I've always been confused as to how Moderna, for example, takes a messenger RNA computer instruction and turns it into a biological material. Is the gene synthesizer, is that what they're using?
It's as simple as in the world of printing, you have cyan, magenta, yellow, and black.
Right.
And in the world of gene synthesizing, you've got adenine, cytosine, guanine, and tryptosine.
Amino acids.
AGCT.
Right.
That's it. You got four of them. Just like four colors in a printer. That's it. And you know, they only go together a certain way. And that's how it works. It's basically like a printer. So the net of it is this Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberger sequences the Spanish flu. And it's categorized and classified as a BSL-4 pathogen, like Ebola, like Marburg virus. All right, so it's at the highest level of balloon suit deep in the thing, right? You got to be deep down, underground, in a balloon suit, the whole, in order to work with this influenza. It is the only influenza strain that is BSL-4, and it is not considered a seasonal influenza. It is considered pandemic.
Okay.
And it's that nomenclature that Dr. Fauci has used to skirt the issue because he keeps comparing COVID to seasonal flu, not pandemic flu.
We should clarify the difference once again because I'm learning so much new stuff here. So a pandemic, is like a one-time flu? Is it like the Spanish flu? How is it? Is it a freak of nature? It's created. It does its worst damage. People get immune to it and it kind of goes away and doesn't come back as opposed to the seasonal, which I guess mutates every year, you know, into different forms. And that's why they try and get the flu shot to cover it. So help me out here. The difference between a pandemic and a seasonal.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. I think the pandemic.
Okay.
Yeah, pandemic influenza we had in 2009, supposedly. We had one back, I think, in 77. We had one in 68. So these are global outbreaks with large amounts of death, destruction, you know, all kinds of nastiness. So
right.
The categorization of the Spanish flu, the H1N1 Spanish flu gene, is BSL-4, same as Ebola, Marburg, the worst viruses on Earth. It is considered the deadliest virus to ever exist. And Fauci and Francis Collins, who just retired, funded the resurrection of it in 2005. Well, Ray Kurzweil, who invented the Braille reading machine and all these wonderful synthesizers, is now a fellow at Google. But 15 years ago, Ray Kurzweil wrote an article for the New York Times with Bill Joy, the founder of Sun, saying Fauci is off the reservation. This is just unbelievable that he's considering doing this. and writes an opinion piece, an op-ed piece for the New York Times. This is Ray Kurzweil and Bill Joy lambasting the notion of reconstructing the Spanish flu. But they did it anyway. They didn't listen to Ray Kurzweil, who, again, today is a Google senior fellow. They didn't listen to Bill Joy. They did it. They did it anyway, and they published it, and they brag about how smart they are, Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberger, that they did this. Well, the symptoms that they start describing of coronavirus are the symptoms of the Blue Death, which is the nickname of the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu produced symptoms where the lips turned blue due to a lack of oxygen getting to the lungs. Okay. And people said it looked like altitude sickness, and they called it the Blue Death. I'm looking at the CDC's mortality data, and we got 4,000 people a week. This is unprecedented, Greg. There's never been 4,000 people a week for 13 weeks dying. That's never happened. Never. I'm looking at the data. I'm looking back to 2003, and all of a sudden we got 4,000 people a week dying of influenza?
And that's not making news, and nobody's noticing, and this is just happening.
No,
and,
it did make – no. It was making news. It was making news in January and as late as February. And I did a bunch of videos on the Johnny Hoover channel. One that I think really kind of spells it out is called the Gene Genie. And it's got a picture of the genie from Aladdin in the thumbnail. And that video shows a whole bunch of news coverage from January and February 2020 where everybody's talking about how this is the worst influenza season we've ever seen. Well, it ends up at the end of October 2020 that season logs 274,000 people die. And I'm like, so what happened was I ended up getting introduced to Laura Ingraham through a viewer. Okay. One of my viewers knew her and sends her some of the stuff, and I end up talking with her on Skype and then emailing back and forth, all kinds of stuff. And she starts tweeting the charts. So I'm making charts showing how many kids have died compared to adults and some of these statistics.
Those are your pie charts,
and she
right?
starts tweeting the charts. Yeah, pie charts and stuff like that, right?
Right.
And she starts tweeting them and asking, you know, why are we closing the schools if there's only this many kids dead in the country, that kind of thing. So she's using my material to send out to the tweets. She and I are communicating behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And she's baffled as well. She can't, you know, it's like, why are they doing, why would they cover this up? Well, I discovered that there's a legal thing. There's, in other words, there's a law that says that in order for there to be an emergency use authorization for vaccine, there can't really be any effective treatment.
Yep. Now you're my ballpark.
I broke that.
Because I know all about this.
Right,
yeah.
Well, all right.
Yeah.
All right. So I broke that story on the Johnny Hoover channel with the actual clause from U.S. code, which nobody had ever addressed before. Nobody ever showed the law.
One person did.
Well, who did? Who did?
Me. Me. In fact, I wrote, we have a bill, but
you
I wrote with Dr.
Zelenko. You guys got into the whole U.S. code thing?
Well,
you guys showed the code?
Dr. Zelenko and I rewrote the law. We have a new, this is what we do here. I know you're not as familiar with what goes on at Action Radio, but this is the first show. Whereas, you know, you talk about evidence-based journalism and then opinion journalism. Well, we are activists. Actually, we're, you know, I call it conservative news advocates, but what we really are is citizen legislators. So I wrote a bill with Dr. Zelenko that overhauls the EUA procedure. Pull up the bill right now. This will probably be new for you. I don't know if we – I'm sure I didn't send it to you. Let me see if it says – in fact, it resulted from the from his first interview with me back in August of 2020. And so let me see if I can get this right here. But what I do with these is I take the old law. So I can quote you the old law. Let me see where it says here. I'm just scrolling down through it. I probably shouldn't do this, you know, on the air. Basically, the way it works is that emergency use authorization can only be granted for a new product if there isn't an existing product already that's, you know, safe and effective, inexpensive, and that kind of thing.
That's right.
So the existing products were hydroxychloroquine, as I learned first from Dr. Zelenko and Dr. Rowe, and then ivermectin, and the things that are being used that they're trying to get early treatments, and that's what the rally in Pensacola was about just recently. So what I did was I said, yes, you can do that. I actually wrote a procedure whereby the president and or the Congress could overrule the FDA, because in law it says the FDA has absolute control over this. I mean, this is the law that Big Pharma bought. So they bought a law in Congress where they could basically say what would be the emergency use. And because the law exists that you can't use something else if something already exists, they had to ban what already exists. So the way I look at this is that they had to ban hydroxychloroquine in order so that they could put get it. Because otherwise they wouldn't get emergency use authorization because hydroxychloroquine already exists.
That's exactly
Okay.
So I didn't know you guys covered this so early. Didn't realize you had covered this so early. Stumbled into it again. I think it was in May of this past year.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got the code up on my screen. It's U.S. Code 21, Section 360, Subsection 3, Authorization for Medical Products for Use in Emergencies. Mm-hmm. And you guys covered it. I made a video about it because Tucker Carlson had Dr. Corey on. And he and Dr. Corey are like banging their heads against the wall. Like, why won't they allow anybody to even talk about ivermectin or hydroxy? And
that's
so
why.
I made a video, exactly, getting into U.S. Code, 21, Section 360, et cetera. And,
360BBB-3C is the actual site.
That's it.
I got it right here. I'm looking right at it.
It says
right in front
of me. Criteria for issuance of authorization. And it says that you can't have an adequate, approved, and available alternative for preventing or treating such disease. So if ivermectin was found to be effective, you wouldn't have an EUA for the vaccine at all.
Exactly. Yeah, we've been talking about that
Maria
for about
Bartiromo.
A year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Maria Bartiromo breaks that on her show with Dr. Corey and Senator Ron Johnson just days after I published my video on YouTube.
Yep.
All right.
He's
so
great.
It appears that one of the producers, it appears, from Maria Bartiromo's show has been watching my show, because when I published the video, she then says to Dr. Corey and Senator Ron Johnson, isn't it true that if ivermectin or hydroxy had been found to be effective, they never would have gotten an EUA? And both Senator Johnson and Dr. Corey are jumping out of their seats to answer the question yes. They're like, thank God somebody finally broached this subject on television. Mm-hmm. Nobody has mentioned
it
before Maria Bartiromo.
Yeah.
Nobody.
No, she's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, they won't cover this in the media. All right, so that's what happened there. The net of this is it appears that based on the data around COVID and on the comorbidities – and on over 300,000 of the people had influenza, and 95% of the people had multiple comorbidities, and only 5% were real true SARS-CoV-2 deaths. Mm-hmm. But we've got 274,000 last season and 410,000 this season. We just experienced an H1N1 Spanish flu pandemic. That's what we just experienced. The part that makes it sick is that there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Timothy Cunningham who used to work at the CDC, and he's dead. Dr. Timothy Cunningham was found floating in the Chattahoochee, apparently of suicide.
I've heard that before.
He had been advocating. Mm-hmm. He'd been advocating for a drug from Japan, from a company called Shionogi. The name of the drug is Xofluza, X-O-F-L-U-Z-A, and it is FDA approved.
Right.
And Xofluza, X-O-F-L-U-Z-A, treats H1N1 in one dose. One dose.
Wow. No wonder they had to
Dr. Timothy Cunningham says, this is so unbelievably effective, we may not need vaccines anymore.
Uh-oh, they shouldn't have said that. That's the kiss of death. I mean, literally, this is what it all comes to. I've said for like about a year and a half, all roads lead to vaccines, that the vaccine was created before the virus, that all this has been planned out. This is, and Dr. Judy Mikovits, who's listening, by the way, she's driving, so she's listening to us, in, wherever she's going. But,
okay,
there's a lot of folks who are on board with this, yeah.
So there's two different viruses. So this is the key thing. There's two viruses. SARS-CoV-2 was manufactured most likely in Wuhan. Most likely Peter Daszak absolutely has his fingerprints on it. What role does SARS-CoV-2 play in this big picture? Dr. Fauci predicts an outbreak.
Right.
He has a virus that Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberg recreated that he knows can wreak havoc. And it's in every BSL-4 laboratory in the world. How many BSL-4 laboratories are there in all of China?
Probably one at Wuhan, I would guess. Yeah.
One. That's it. There's only one. The United States has them all over the place, right? They're in Galveston, they're in Kansas, they're all over the place in the United States.
Okay.
China only has one. Hmm. There's only one in China, okay? Australia, in 2019, they have the worst influenza season in history.
Wow.
June, July, August, September of 2019, Australia has its worst influenza season in history since the Spanish flu. And then 100-and-something athletes from Australia travel to Wuhan to compete in the Wuhan games. How many of them were infected with H1N1?
Probably none of them.
They start wrestling.
Or did they?
No, probably all of them.
Oh, they're all from Australia, not from Wuhan. Right.
Right. So a whole bunch of athletes from Australia that just had its worst influenza season in history travel to Wuhan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the influenza outbreak from Australia had also spread to other Southern Hemisphere countries. So there were other countries in the Southern Hemisphere having a terrible outbreak of influenza in the summer of 2019, what we call summer in the Northern Hemisphere, June, July, August.
I used to live there.
Those people go to Wuhan. All right, so Wuhan then has this outbreak of pneumonia is how it's described.
Okay.
It's an outbreak of pneumonia is how it's originally described. Now, if it's allowed to go as H1N1 and they start sequencing it, it's going to point right back to Walter Reed. Somebody's going to look at it and go, hey, this is Taubenberger's H1N1 here.
So H1N1 is Spanish flu. I thought it was like a different one. H1N1 is... Spanish flu, correct.
Okay, so Fauci needs another virus that he can pin on the Chinese so that the, in other words, as this thing starts to spread around the world, the people in the Netherlands are going to put it in a petri dish and go, hey, wait a second, this is Taubenberger's H1N1 Spanish flu thing. What the hell? How did this get out of the lab?
So he needs another virus to cover.
Fauci has Peter Daszak. Right. Okay. You know the symptoms are going to be identical. He knows the symptoms are identical because he engineered it with the CGG, CGG, and the furin cleavage site. He knows what the symptoms are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter Daszak is not an American. So he can pin it on Peter Daszak. Peter Daszak is the bad guy. Peter Daszak releases SARS-CoV-2 at the Wuhan games.
Okay.
Now you got two viruses in circulation. One that you're going to have the press talk about, and the other that you're going to have the CIA help you cover up, because it points back to the United States. We built it.
Yep.
We recreated it. Ray Kurzweil warned against it.
Mm-hmm.
But according to the CDC, there's 410,000 people this season dead from it and 274,000 last year. And if it's not the H1N1 Spanish flu, well, then what the hell is it? How do you kill 400,000 people in a year with a virus?
So the when people
COVID,
on the ventilators,
SARS-CoV-2,
right? Yeah, it's not SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah, SARS-CoV-2 has like 99 people in Shanghai.
Yeah, SARS-CoV-2 is like 99.5% on average ineffective. It doesn't do anything. I mean, it gets you a little sick, but you know, it never made sense to me that it's something that is so ineffective that has such a high quote survivability rate, which is not even a good word for it, can kill that many people. And also, I've heard that the actual mortality rate overall hasn't really increased. So what's going on?
There aren't 10 dead in Shanghai. If there's not 10 dead in Shanghai and there's not 10 dead in Beijing and there wasn't anybody dead in Vietnam for the longest time, they had 135 people dead.
No China virus.
Then they started their vaccination.
Well, here's the weird
then they started their vaccination program.
I'm going to hold you for just backstage just for a second because that's a whole story into itself. But I remember when we first broke the story, when Bill Gertz broke it, when we talked about back in February 25th of 2020, that the Wuhan lab was responsible for this new virus coming out. We didn't even know what it was yet. March 2nd, I quote the Diderot study that chloroquine kills what we're now calling COVID. Okay, so that's only like a week later. March 15th is the 15 days to slow the spread. And I'm screaming, no, don't do this. There's no reason to do it. But then the Wuhan story disappears for about a year and then it comes back. And I'm saying, why is this coming back? Why is the story coming back now? Why is it? Why was I suspended from Facebook for 90 days? You know, on the same post on three different places sequentially, they did that, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, now then it comes back, and now it's an improved story. Okay, so wait a minute, something's really wrong here. This story is being brought back for a purpose, and I didn't know what it was until now, until you told me that this makes sense. So I want to know how the whole complicated thing works. I know the vaccines, all roads lead to vaccines. I know this is the source of all this. It's about the billions and billions of dollars and the money and the power and the whole bit. But what I'm wondering is how the interaction of the two viruses and why Spanish flu wasn't discovered, and does it take away your taste and smell, you know, like, you know, did that do it back in 1918? Mm-hmm. And is it all the, are all the same symptoms, and why nobody said, wait a minute, these are the Spanish flu symptoms. What the hell are we doing with this, the SARS-CoV-2 nonsense? These are the questions I have. So I'm just going to let you go again. Just kind of, you know, help.
Sure.
Let's
sure.
dig out.
Sure.
Yeah. Go for it.
All right. So we got very similar symptoms. When you listen to doctors talk about the Spanish flu, H1N1, 1918, they talk about something called the cytokine storm.
Yeah. I heard that term. Go ahead, define that one.
And they say that the cytokine storm was unique to the Spanish flu H1N1.
Oh.
And one doctor who does a thing on video says the first time I've ever even heard of a cytokine storm was when I started studying the Spanish flu.
Okay.
All right. So we see these common symptoms between the two, number one. Okay. Mm-hmm. Number two. We see this remarkable shift to PCR testing instead of cultures. Why?
Oh, that's it. And we know that doesn't work. I'll tell you why. They have to magnify it 40 times. And, you know, we're report on that, but I'm sure you have more details.
Again,
so.
Go ahead. Right. So I kind of want the audience to understand that there has been like this alternative narrative, and the alternative narrative is also nonsense. Okay.
Okay.
So the whole thing with the PCR test and amping, yes, that's true.
But that's not really the problem.
But you don't understand why the PCR tests are being used. Right. So why are they using a PCR test?
Because they can't sell flu
PCR
from
tests only,
COVID.
Right. PCR tests only detect what you tell it to detect. The BioFire PCR respiratory array has 22 pathogens that it tests for. Not 23, not 21, 22 pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 22 pathogens, 7 of them are influenza viruses. And in fact, one of them is the seasonal version of H1N1 called H1N1 PDM09, which is a seasonal version of H1N1, not the reconstructed pandemic version.
Is it a mutation, a weaker version? What is it? I'm curious. I've never heard of this.
Yeah. So the version from the swine flu was not the pandemic version. It was slightly different. And that's why there were only 12,000 people that died in 2009. Only 12,000 people. That's nothing. I mean, we've got over 70,000 dead in California right now, supposedly from COVID.
Wow.
Right. So again, now, the next bit of information the audience may not be aware of, that I just published a video on Rumble because I've been banned from YouTube for 3 weeks. So I publish on Rumble, and the channel on Rumble is called I Am John Cullen. Mm-hmm. And I just published a video that goes state by state through the United States and answers the question, how many school-aged children have died in your state? How many school-age kids between 5 and 17 have died with COVID in Vermont? How many died in Connecticut? What about Massachusetts? What about Virginia? Do you know? And if you don't know, why don't you know that? Mm-hmm. Who hasn't told you that? Has your governor told you how many school-age kids have died in your state? And if not, why not? How many school-age kids died in New Jersey between 5 and 17 with COVID? And why doesn't nobody know that?
I think it's what, like,
so I just published a video on Rumble.
Yeah,
so on Rumble, and you can find that. So which state were you saying, 20 or 30? Where?
Well, I'm just saying that I know it's an extremely low amount, and of those kids that died, they had comorbidities too.
Right. They had things like cystic fibrosis, right? So these are kids that had cystic fibrosis that tested positive for COVID.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm.
So break the numbers down. Mm-hmm. COVID numbers don't hold water, and the influenza numbers are all sitting there. Nobody wants to dig in. Now, how do you miss Spanish flu? How do you miss it?
Yeah.
You don't put
question.
It in the PCR test.
Okay.
You don't put it in the PCR test.
Oh, wait,
it doesn't exist.
Spanish flu is left out
in the lab.
Okay.
Of course. Is Ebola, when you go to get tested for COVID,
right?
Does it tell you if, oh, by the way, you've got Ebola? No, there's no Ebola test in there. They're not testing for Ebola. Right?
Or
so if they're not testing for Ebola or Marburg, they're not testing for H1N1 reconstructed Spanish flu because it only exists in a laboratory as far as they're telling you.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
But you've got 700,000 people dead from PNI in the last two seasons. It's unprecedented. And it's according to the CDC. In other words, we're counting death certificates. This is not an estimate. This isn't a ball. We've got hard numbers of death certificates by state of influenza deaths. So it appears Fauci released the Taubenberger strain and then released the SARS-CoV-2 to cover up for it so that everybody wouldn't be looking at Walter Reed. That's why Fauci's perfectly happy for everybody to yak about Wuhan, Wuhan, Wuhan. The longer they talk about Wuhan, the longer they're not looking at Walter Reed, Jeffrey Taubenberger, Ann Reed, and the project to reconstruct the deadliest virus on Earth.
Okay, we've got this is mind-blowing information. Obviously, I got to catch up on all your videos. We have about 50 minutes left before Claire Lopez joins us, foreign intelligence CIA person. You're welcome to stick around if you have the time. But I want to know, should we start into the vaccine connection? Do you want to kind of hold up now and do this another time, because I don't want to shortchange you on any of the information, because you're presenting it in such a logical, wonderful way that we're going to keep these podcasts and, of course, highlight them and everything else. But
We can wrap up on
You got 15 minutes.
I've been hesitant to really get into the vaccine stuff because, from my perspective, why would you vaccinate? Why would you inoculate people against something that's most likely not going to kill them? Right.
Well, that's what I wonder. So, yeah, exactly. It's so survivable. Why would you even bother? Why would you do it with the kids who have the greatest, survival, the least, the kids are affected the least. Here's the thing, too. You talk about this as a oxygen depleting thing. This is a question that I think we can get into a little bit now. If masks deplete your oxygen, they're having airline pilots who are rejecting this. Cabin pressures of airliners are at 8,000 feet. It's a depletion of oxygen. Don't exercise. Don't go to the beach. Don't exercise. Don't stay at home. That increases your stress and reduces your oxygen just because of the lack of exercise. I mean, everything they've done has been to make this virus, whichever one, either the Spanish flu or the COVID virus, they've increased it. Everything, every lockdown, every stress, every anxiety, every depression, every alcoholism, addiction that people are getting, every loss of jobs and everything else like that, everything they have done systematically makes a virus worse. That's got to be by design.
Well, I keep and that's why I've continued to compare various locales. So in other words, I've compared New York to Japan. I've compared Michigan to Malaysia. I compared Kansas to China. Why does Kansas have more people dead than China? Why does Michigan have more people dead than Malaysia? Why would things like that be happening? Well, to wrap up on the vaccines, the reason for my reluctance was because SARS-CoV-2 is not the virus that's killing everybody.
Yeah.
So talking about a solution for SARS-CoV-2, to me, is a waste of time. In other words, if SARS-CoV-2 has killed 30,000 people in the United States, but influenza just killed 680,000, shouldn't we be talking about Zofluza and not hydroxychloroquine? Seem insensitive to the 30,000 that died.
Zofluza.
Zofluza. X-O. F-L-U-Z-A. And it's from a company called Shionogi in Japan. And this was the drug that Timothy Cunningham was advocating for when he killed himself in the Chattahoochee.
Yeah, sure he did.
So he was saying that this is so effective, we may not need influenza vaccines anymore. This is a, you take two pills in a one day, and that's it. Two tablets in a 24-hour period, you're done.
Well, I never understood why you'd have a vaccine for a disease that somebody already has. You know, that's too late. You need a vaccine before you take a vaccine, you know, before you go to a country with an infectious disease. You don't take it after. It isn't any good.
I would take a vaccine for a disease I'm afraid is going to kill me or paralyze me, right? So to me, those are the things I'm interested in getting a vaccine for. Okay. A respiratory infection that I might get 102 fever, the hell do I need that for? Now, if I have other, if I have comorbidity, if I have other underlying conditions that might lead to my death, well, maybe I should look into a vaccine like the pneumonia vaccine that protects against all these different kinds of pneumonia, since that's what seems to kill everybody when they get the influenza or the COVID is really the pneumonia. Maybe something like Pneumovax would give me more. So I'm not an anti-vax guy. I'm certainly anti-putting stuff into vaccines. It's going to have an adverse. Like, I don't like, what do they call them, adjuvants. The whole idea of putting salt in the vaccine really
squalene, the one that's
squalene,
in the
stuff like, yeah.
And that's related to Gulf War
really
syndrome.
Really upsets me. Yeah. The whole thing. I mean, all they use that. They use aluminum salts. There's all kinds of stuff that they use as adjuvants. And that really upsets me. Yeah. The thing that Dr. Judy shared with me about the timing of the MMR vaccine and the difference between giving the MMR vaccine to a two-year-old versus a three-year-old kid can make all the difference in whether or not they develop autism, right? These are things I was not aware of. That doesn't make
that.
You
– yeah.
Yeah, so that doesn't make you anti-vaccine. It just means you want to be an educated consumer when it comes to your own health care, and not everything is equally efficacious. Can't be. Right? Yeah. Everything can't be exactly the same in risk and efficaciousness, right? There's got to be some variance. So that doesn't make you anti-vax to want to understand the difference. So for me, a vaccine against a virus that killed maybe 30 to 35,000 in the United States is far less interesting than a tablet called Xofluza that may have prevented 600 or 700,000 deaths. Now, the issue
is it still available?
If you don't look,
is it commercially available? So can you buy it? Yeah.
Sure. Yes.
Okay. So it's not a banned product.
The issue is your physician.
Right.
Right. So here's sort of the bottom line.
Okay.
Somehow, everybody all over the world stopped doing cultures.
Oh.
Why is that? And how is that? How is it that nobody will take a swab, put it in a Petri dish, and grow it for 3 days in a BSL-3 laboratory anymore? Why can't
throat.
We get that done?
For the most
right?
Infections.
Well, that's,
yeah.
Greg, that's what happened here. The modus operandi, the way you pull this off, is you get everybody to switch to PCR testing. Then, like you said, now I can crank up the cycle, so I'll find that SARS-CoV-2 on a piece of rice if I can run the cycles 50 times. I'll find I'll find it on a piece of pizza crust. I'm going to find a little SARS-CoV-2 on there.
Well, everyone's got some of it. We've all been exposed to it several times, probably.
If it's airborne, that's right, exactly. If it's airborne, if you run it through the multiplier enough times, you're going to find it. But if there's no Ebola in the test array, and there's no Marburg virus in the test array, and there's no reconstructed pandemic influenza in the test array, you could come in. By the way, Greg, how many of the people in the United States who think they died of COVID actually had tuberculosis? And how would we know, since not a single damn physician in the country tested anybody for tuberculosis? Tuberculosis didn't go away. Many people had tuberculosis and were misdiagnosed.
Yeah. And that's a lung disease. That's a Vatican storm causing thing, right? Which we didn't really define, but I'm going to do some research. I'll follow up with our
people
folks here.
People die from it. Right. So if you don't test people for the reconstructed pandemic influenza, you're not going to find it. And right. Dr. Fauci and Jeffrey Taubenberger have not provided that gene to BioFire, Eplex, any of the guys who make the PCR tests. They don't have the reconstructed pandemic ones in there. So when they test you, they say, no, you don't have the flu. And what they're telling you is, no, you don't have these five seasonal flus. You don't have any of those.
Yeah. But you get a
Spanish
flu.
But then when you die, right, after you die, the medical examiner says, oh, it was influenza. And so, yeah, we've got about 700,000 people in the United States that have died of PNI, of pneumonia and influenza in the last 2 years. And
wow.
That's the dirty secret that Fauci does. So Fauci's happy for you to keep talking about Wuhan, keep talking about Peter Daszak, keep talking about SARS-CoV-2, because the minute Jeffrey Taubenberger's name comes up and reconstructed pandemic influenza, that's when Fauci goes to prison. Because these people didn't have to die. We have a treatment. We have medicine for them. And we didn't give it to any of them. We let them die.
Yeah, that is the genocide of the century. I call him a genocidal psychopathic drug pusher for a reason. Dr. Fascist, I mean, he is as cruel and barbaric as anybody that's ever existed. My question, and I got Claire Lopez on the
now
line,
we have the death
if you have a minute to get her on. But here's the
big
question.
Now we have the death certificates to prove it.
Yeah. Oh no. You've done some amazing work. I mean, congratulations to you. You're a modern hero.
Yeah.
But here's my question.
Walked into it. This was luck.
You sure did.
Yeah, it was luck.
You definitely did. I know
well,
that
the
feeling.
I think the why was apparent at
why
Georgetown.
Why bring back Spanish flu?
The why was apparent.
Question. Okay.
Because it affected what they needed to affect. They were not expecting Trump to win the election in 2016. By January of 2017, Fauci knew what the plan was. We just played the clip. Fauci
right.
announces a surprise outbreak. If you can scare everybody into their homes, you can force a vote by mail. You can force a vote by mail situation.
Right.
There were very powerful people that didn't want to see a second term. Very powerful people.
You want to name them? I don't mind.
And George Soros, Bill Gates, Mike Bloomberg, Laureen Powell Jobs, Mark Benioff, everyone.
Barack Obama.
Everyone. Barack Obama, correct. Yep. Everyone
Hillary Clinton.
A billionaire.
Yeah.
Hillary, but they're not billionaires. So Barack and Hillary aren't billionaires. Soros, Mike Bloomberg. Mike Bloomberg controls Johns Hopkins. It's the Mike Bloomberg School of Health at Johns Hopkins.
Oh,
that's the map.
That's interesting.
That's the map. Okay. Yeah. Mike Bloomberg said he's going to use all of his resources to make sure the Orange Man doesn't win. And he sure did, didn't he? He used that map in one hell of a way to bring forth panic.
Yeah, it's a terror weapon.
And the world panic.
Yeah.
Correct. So they used it basically to stop him and to force election by mail. They knew if they could do vote by mail, they could control the outcome. And so the virus created a vote by mail scenario that Hillary was already talking about within weeks. She was all ready to start talking about, well, we're going to have the election by mail. You're not going to be able to vote in person. It's too scary. So but the other thing is Fauci didn't think he was going to have a vaccine for 18 months. He did an interview with Zuckerberg that I published.
Okay.
And in that interview with Zuckerberg, he said, yeah, no, we're not going to have a vaccine. It's going to be 18 months at best. So I think something happened along the way that changed. Because early on, he was just talking about masks and distancing, and they didn't have any therapeutic. And to this day, there's no FDA-approved therapeutic treatment that's oral. The only one is remdesivir, and that's intravenous.
Oh, that's terrible.
And it was designed for Ebola.
50% of the test subjects died on remdesivir of kidney failure and other problems. We heard about that Tuesday. I've heard about that for a long time. Gilead, that whole company.
Yeah. Well, that was designed for Ebola and was not approved. So it was ineffective.
Right.
Ineffective for Ebola, not approved, ready to go to the garbage pile. And then they approved it for this. But it's not oral. You have to get it intravenously. So that means that today there's no FDA-approved oral therapeutic to treat SARS-CoV-2. There's none. Merck is seeking approval for molnupiravir.
Oh, you still there?
Seeking emergency use authorization for that.
Okay. Can you just drop it off for a second? And I got Claire on the line, too. I'm going to make her line live here. But
all right. I'm about done.
Okay, no, this has been brilliant, and like I say, I'm the boss here, so I can sort of regulate the schedule here. I wanted to let you go, and I'm glad we had this extra 15 minutes. I'd love to come back and talk to you about our bill, the bill that I wrote last year, I think it was August of 2020, yeah. To fix this, and the fact that the people that you're in contact could, if you want to endorse our bill, if you read it, see what you think, if you can get it to some of these people, like I've been trying to get it to Senator Johnson, to various people, Scott Atlas, Laura Ingraham, people you mentioned before, all have in their, with their minions, our mail. I want to bring Claire on. Claire, do you have any questions for John Collin? I don't know how much you've listened to the show. I've been on for about 10 minutes. You don't have to. But I want to give you the option if you have, find this on the
Good morning. Excuse me. I have been listening in. Very interesting. Very interesting conversation.
Oh, yeah. Whether you hear from the beginning, this is mind-blowing. I got Josie on line, too. Josie's one of our reporters, a Central South American reporter. And Josie, if you have a quick question for John Collin, I know he has to go pretty soon, next couple of minutes.
Yes, I have a quick question, and good morning. My question to you is, since Donald Trump made the vaccines quickly, are the vaccines that are killing all these people, are the vaccines that Donald Trump made? Or did they spike the vaccines to kill people?
Ooh, great question. John?
That hasn't been my area of focus. Again, I've been less focused on the vaccines. what I can tell you is that early on, Dr. Fauci didn't think they would have a vaccine to administer in the December timeframe at all. He was back when he did his interview with Zuckerberg, he was talking about the summer of the following year. So he was saying, maybe by September 2021, October 20. So basically he was saying by this time now, we would have a vaccine. He didn't expect it that soon. So I don't know what happened behind the scenes.
So wait a minute. He created the Spanish. He resurrected the Spanish flu virus without the intention of having a vaccine for it, but have a vaccine for something that wasn't that deadly.
This is crazy. First they resurrected,
right?
So when they resurrected the Spanish flu, you can read all about this, by the way, at the CDC. So the CDC tells you the story. It's not a secret. And Sports Illustrated did a whole story about it. They resurrected. They get the sequence, and now for the last 15, 16 years, Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberger has been sucking up research funds trying to build a universal vaccine for influenza. All right, so you give him $4 million a year for 16 years, and he works on the universal vaccine. They're really hard to make, so they take a long time. So you got to keep funding his research, and you got to keep funding his research, and you got to keep funding his research. And so here we are 16 years later, and they're still talking about a universal vaccine for influenza.
Which changes every year.
The deadliest. The deadliest one of all time. Wow. Yes.
Listen,
so
I'll get one.
It's the sort of thing.
Hold on real fast. I want to get to Lita, who's been listening for a ton of time on the show, too. And then I want to get to Claire because, we have just a whole bunch of other stuff to talk about. Lita, you got a quick question for John Collin? And then we're going to I'll get him back again. I mean, we just have so much more to talk about. Lita, did you have a question or no?
Not really. I'm still processing all of this, and it's kind of overwhelming. I'm, like, blown away. Would you be open to speaking at certain places to educate people that are open to this?
Like we have a Tallahassee rally, week Saturday. Is that something you do, John, or do you want to?
For me to do it. It's a little difficult for me to do it physically, but I'm happy to participate by Skype with video. Okay. And with materials, and if you want to get a sense of the materials and the type of thing I do, I did a citizens grand jury presentation for Larry Klayman, that you can find on YouTube, and you can get a sense of what it looks like when I present to a group of people a bunch of facts and charts and stuff. And yes, I'm glad to do that. Happy to do that to a parent-teachers conference or a college or, yeah, happy to do it.
Yeah, I'm going to get you some, in touch with some folks. We'll do that off the air.
Okay.
Josie, last comment, and then I want to talk to Claire. John, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's invaluable information. I love it. You've changed all my thinking. I have to go process this myself now. Just ahead.
The reason I asked this question about the vaccine is because a lot of people are telling me, oh, so the vaccine is killing everybody that Trump created. But you have to put your thinking cap. Remember how Hollywood, the Obamas, the Clinton, everybody says we will never, ever, ever take Donald Trump's vaccine. So now what they're doing is they're forcing you, they're paying you, they're giving you a scholarship, they're doing everything. So something happened, and that's the reason I was asking you that question.
Yeah, we can speculate. John, if you want to do that real quickly, and then I want to I have to move on. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show. And you're welcome to stick around and listen as we go into foreign affairs, intelligence, and things like that.
The most startling thing regarding the vaccines, from my perspective, has to do with the countries that had no one dead.
Yeah.
I look at Vietnam, I look at Laos, I look at Cambodia, and for a year, there was no one dead. Then they started their vaccination program. And if you go to the map, you see now they got plenty of people dead. Yeah. So that's where it upsets me greatly. But then there's other places like Peru where they implemented their vaccination program. People stopped dying. So Jason and I started asking, is it refrigeration? Is it handling? Is it different vaccines? Turns out there's 22, 25 different vaccines around the world. Cuba made their own. Kazakhstan made their own. So there's all sorts of different vaccines around the world that are being used. Some appear to be more efficacious than others. Whatever they're doing in Russia, more people are dying in Russia this week than at any other time during the pandemic. Russia is having the worst part of its outbreak right now, and they're using Sputnik. So I don't know. I can't tell you what's happening with these vaccines. My focus has been, I'm not going to talk about a vaccine for a virus that hasn't killed 2,000 people younger than 45 in the United States. I want to focus on the problem that killed 600,000 people.
Yeah.
Because that is the big secret. That's what Fauci doesn't want you to know about. Jeffrey Taubenberger and reconstructed pandemic influenza.
Yeah. I'm going to do a lot of research. I'm going to ask
thank
you to come
you.
Back when you can. Let's and John, like I said, you're welcome to stay on the line. You're welcome to listen in if you want. If you have to leave, I understand that perfectly too. Claire, thank you so much for your patience this week. It's been just an incredible opportunity to have John on to be able to get here and get the information that we have. Does any of this do you hear about this in Russia? Are you as you keep your ear to the foreign intelligence, are there different things coming up around the world? Like Moderna, for example, now has a factory in Africa. Africa has, chloroquine. They don't have a problem with COVID as much for a whole bunch of reasons. Claire, what's your take on this so far? Then we can specific on,
well,
on other issues.
Well, my my focus really has been on China.
Okay.
More recently, I'm sorry, morning frog in my throat here.
That's okay.
And
for all of us.
The Chinese Communist Party, together with the People's Liberation Army Biological Weapons Program, because, of course, that's where the virus came from. It was genetically engineered in PLA labs in China. Now, to introduce a vaccine of any kind in the middle, smack in the middle of a pandemic, is absurd, because what you're doing, of course, is encouraging, you're instigating the escape mutants, as they've called them, which means kind of Darwin's survival of the fittest, right?
Antibody-dependent enhancement,
escapes,
right?
The virus that escapes or somehow survives whatever type of vaccine it may be, that's the one that's going to go on and propagate, and that's exactly what's happening, in addition to the fact that viruses mutate like crazy just by nature anyway. And the answer, of course, has always been early intervention with prophylactic drugs, which are readily available in many places. I mean, look at India. They have introduced the use of ivermectin early on, and deaths are reduced drastically. I mean, they're just not even a factor anymore.
Yeah. India's a great case study.
The different results in different countries mm-hmm. could be the result of, you know, different vaccines. So different vaccine allows the different virus mutations mm-hmm. To escape, you know what I mean, in each place. It'll be different.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you're seeing the different outcomes.
Well, you know, it'll be interesting is to find out which ones are traditional vaccines that actually take inert, you know, actual DNA from the virus, and those that are doing messenger RNA.
We have never had the actual original genetic sequence, and it doesn't matter now anymore because that's no longer extant anyway. Mm. The variations that are circulating now are not the original anyway, but we never had the original genetic sequence. Of course, China's not going to give us that.
Yeah.
And
John, you may hear things you disagree with, you know, and it's such another, everybody's free to talk about this. I find Claire fascinating just for the amount of things that she knows. So, you know, I don't want to debate any particular issue here, but to just, because Claire and I we've had our debates in the past. It's been quite interesting. I'm, you know, curious about the whole bioweapons aspect of this, and this is something that we need to explore more, you know, especially with the John's revelations on the Spanish flu. So in the worldwide situation, you know, as nations vie for power and resources and wealth and control, does COVID figure into the big plan for some nations or not? I mean, no, it does
well,
for China for bioweapons.
Those places,
okay.
Those leaderships that do not subscribe to the liberal, you know, consent of the governed style of Western representative government,
mm-hmm.
Are the ones that took most advantage. And I mean right here in the United States, cities, municipalities, and so forth,
right.
took most advantage of the situation in order to expand their own control. I mean, that is the nature of tyrants everywhere. And
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter what the crisis is. They will use it to their own advantage to grab power. And once grabbed, it'll be mighty hard to get it back.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting how they would literally use anything. Of course, this is like the perfect opportunity. And when I think tyrants, I always come back to Dr. Fascist, you know, and I call him that for a reason, as
well,
I stated earlier.
Well, I mean, he would have absolutely no influence if it were not permitted. He's a nobody.
Right.
He's nothing.
Okay.
But he was permitted. He was permitted a leading role. I love President Donald Trump for so many reasons, and he did so much good for this country in his 4 years,
but
I think he made some serious mistakes in terms of, I think overall, if I had to categorize it, I would say in terms of personnel, his appointments and trust in certain people, I think was badly misplaced, and
yeah.
Fauci's one of them. I mean, he should have been fired a long time ago. He would have zero interest if Congress, you know, the NIH, the NIAID, his shop, were not funding, were not providing the funds. The funds are legally appropriated by Congress. If that were stopped, so would his influence be stopped. Of course, he could be fired any time, too, and he hasn't.
Should have been, yeah.
Should have been.
Well, we had a guest previously. These are great points. It's quite fascinating. We had a guest, Patrick Wood, who does a publication called Technocracy. You know, the merging of technology and bureaucracy. And he was making the point that every country has a Dr. Fascist, that there are these public health people that, you know, at least, you know, in this country have created this mistaken belief that, you know, public health dictates supersede the Constitution, that your rights don't exist if they say there's a pandemic. Of course, it's all nonsense, but there's too many people believing it. So the impact of bureaucrats in this, are the bureaucrats leading the leaders, or are the leaders using the bureaucrats? What kind of relationship do they have in countries that you've seen?
Well, I mean, it's a particular community at the global level, and I don't think most people understand how that works.
Please
the
tell.
Public health scientist community at the top levels, WHO, Louis Pasteur, a set of laboratories across the world, just by one example. And the scientists who operate at that level it's their own community. And it's broad, it's worldwide. They are all colleagues. They all work together. And to know that, just go to the scientific papers, which, you know, I read voluminously, and look at the authors list at the top of each one. Now, there's a French guy there. There's a Chinese scientist. There's an American researcher. You know, they're full of different nationalities, those author lists. It's its own community worldwide. They all go to the same conferences. They all know each other. They all exchange research and grants. And that's the other link to this, is the international funding, meaning often philanthropic foundations like, you know, Bill Gates and Ford and Rockefeller and go on and on.
Yeah, like John was mentioning.
And it's a symbiotic relationship amongst them that most people don't understand, that operates on a different level and in a different world that we inhabit.
Yeah, it's a bubble. It's another bubble. You know, I'm reminded as you're talking about that of General Milquetoast, you know, General Milley, who says, I contacted my counterpart in China. How does he even know his counterpart to contact him? I mean, you would think that that a nation as dangerous and competitive and aggressive as China, you know, one general would not be calling up another general, especially, I mean, this is treasonous to me that he would call them up and alert for what might be, you know, his perception that, well, we might be attacking China, we can't trust Trump.
Well, I mean,
the military has their own problem too, right?
The Secretary of Defense's job to have working relationships with the ministers of defense of major countries around the world.
Okay.
Just as it was General Mike Flynn's job as National Security Advisor for President Trump early in 2017 to have relationships with the senior national security leadership, including ambassadors of other major countries. That's their job.
Okay.
But it is not General Milley's job to offer a pre-attack warning to an adversary contact like that. That was not his job. But to have the relationship, absolutely. Of course he has to have the relationship.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure why they would be so connected. Here's something I've been wondering, too, about this for a while. It never occurred to Milley, or maybe it did, but it occurred to me that if Trump had wanted China to think that he might be attacking, or he wanted to appear more aggressive, or whatever it was he wanted to do to give that perception to China without actually saying it, because there's this whole world of signals and diplomacy that I don't even understand, Milley would have ruined that by calling him and saying, well, I'm going to let you know what's going on, you know, confirming basically that Trump was not doing that. So where does the psychology of you know, leaders, top leaders like President Trump in a relationship with Xi Jinping, you know, communist leader in China, you know, of what Trump might want him to think that would have been ruined by Milley's action of, you know, contacting his counterpart?
Well,
what
I mean, in this relationship between the United States and China, I think openness and transparency is paramount in order to avoid missteps, misperceptions.
Okay.
I think transparency is extremely important. But again, what General Milley did, I think, was way beyond, you know, the purview of his job, and bordering on not just insubordination but treason.
Yeah, so that's more than just a reprimand and a resignation. That's a court martial with charges. I got one of your biggest fans on the line, Josie. So I want to go to her, see if you have a question.
Okay.
Josie, do you have a question for Claire?
I don't have a question, but
I think I surprised her.
Yes, what the gentlemen were telling me, because I started listening a little late, so I didn't catch his name and all that at the beginning. But
John Cullen.
Some of my people some of the people from Cuba, they were telling me that Cuba made their own vaccine, and I thought they were just saying that, but now he assured me this morning that Cuba made their own vaccine. And the other thing is, if the vaccines in America were not being spiked, like Dr. Judy Mikovits said, then we will not be forcing people to take Donald Trump's vaccine because they were against it 100% from the very beginning.
Well, that all flipped on November the 3rd. They pivoted on a dime by November the 4th. And I mean, it's not Donald Trump's vaccine. It's the United States public health.
What they were
Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, et cetera, Johnson & Johnson. it's their vaccines, and around the world, other countries and other companies produce their own vaccines. I mean, they're not spiked. That kind of stuff is crazy talk.
Enough as they exist. They're bad enough the way they're produced normally without putting extra stuff in that.
The thing about it is not that they exist or not that the companies are trying to develop them, but mm-hmm. rather that they were rushed so much into use mm-hmm. and forced use in the midst of the pandemic. And again, I go back to what I said in the beginning. When you introduce a vaccine, of course, the messenger RNA genetic therapy is not a vaccine per se by definition, but call it a vaccine in air quotes, okay? In the midst of a pandemic, you introduce that in the midst of the pandemic, you absolutely ensure that the virus, it's not alive, but we're talking about it kind of as if it were, right? Finds a way to evade, or at least some viruses find a way to evade whatever you're bringing against it. This is just normal, natural survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
You don't introduce a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic.
It's
you
too
introduce
late.
Prophylactic therapeutics, yeah. but not yeah. a vaccine.
Well, this is
part
I wanted to get with John.
There will
too.
Be escapees, and those escapees will propagate and spread. And that's exactly what's happening.
Well, this is the curiosity. Like I said, I was going to ask John about this too, is that why would...
No,
you guys can disagree.
I disagree.
We do a lot of that.
I disagree because...
Go ahead.
I talk to nurses daily, and Donald Trump will not make a vaccine. I'm saying Donald Trump because that's what the Democrats were calling it. Everybody said we will never, ever, ever take Donald Trump's vaccine, which I know is not Donald Trump's vaccine, of course.
Well, that was political.
But the
vaccine didn't change.
Donald Trump will not get involved on something that is going to murder so many people, and that's exactly what's happening.
Well, he's not a medical expert.
He
had no idea. He trusted the wrong people. He's not a medical expert. He's an expert on many things, and I give him the credit for a lot. But he doesn't know medicine or epidemiology or virology from a hole in the wall. He had to rely on those who were advising him, and they, many of them, not all, many, gave him poor advice.
So do you think Joe Biden, Michelle Obama, and all of them taking the vaccine, do you think they're going to take a deadly vaccine in their arm now that they have done
it? Well,
on
they're
TV
not medical experts
Hollywood?
Either. They haven't a bloody clue what's going in their arm. They have no idea.
I understand that Donald Trump doesn't know anything about medicine. He knows about money.
But Joe Biden or any of the rest, they don't know anything about it. They take the advice of those who advise them. And when you have those around you who are giving you poor advice, you take poor advice. That's what they've done.
And how come none of them are dying from the vaccine? And
I don't want anyone to die from the vaccine. I'm glad they're not. Good thing. I wouldn't want that to happen.
Josie, I want to hold you up on this for a bit. I want to hold you up on this because I got we only have limited time with Claire each week, and I want to get on some of the foreign issues. And I'm getting tired of the vaccine debate. I mean, I really am. But we'll talk. We did that with John, but I want to get on to some of the other things that are going on. One of the things we talked about with Dr. Pry earlier this week on Peter Pry on Monday was the idea of limited nuclear deterrence for South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, possibly. I think we talked about this with you briefly, but given what's going on in China, the fact that it looks like it's not if but when they're going to be going into Taiwan, what's your intelligence on that?
Well, I think the most important thing to do, and to some measure, the United States, Britain, Japan are doing this is to deter China, to make Taiwan so difficult, so indigestible, if you will, mm-hmm. That it's not worth their while to do it, at least at this moment, at least right now. And show a force of U.S. and U.K. carriers transiting the Taiwan Straits, for example. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Statements from the foreign ministry in Japan to the effect that the Quad, that means Japan, India, U.S., and Australia, should stand up in defense of Taiwan. All of these contribute to deterrence, and that's where we need to be right now. It's deterrence. The United States, U.K., new agreement with Australia to provide them with nuclear-powered submarines that are orders of magnitude more advanced, more modern, can dive deeper, stay below the water far, far longer, run way quieter than conventional diesel engine submarines, for example. All of these measures are part of deterrence. That's why you see these things happening. It's a pattern. They're talking to each other, okay? And
which
the
is
idea
good.
Is yeah. is to yes, is to put up a wall of deterrence that at least makes Beijing think twice or three or four times before mounting an actual offensive invasion of Taiwan.
Well, how big is Taiwan? I think it has like 6 million people, and how close is it to China?
Well, I mean,
if you know.
Relatively
look
speaking,
it up
and... it's quite close. You know, it's
okay.
It's not far off of the shore at all, which is, you know, why it was in times past a province of the Han Dynasty of China, right?
Okay.
Along with many of the other nearby islands, Kumoi and others like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, after the 1949 conquest of mainland China by Mao Zedong and the communists, and Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang fled offshore to Taiwan, that is when the conflict, you know, about Taiwan's status began in modern times anyway.
Yeah. Considering the size of it, would it have any particular impact on China in terms of, you know, new people, new industry, new income, new economy, or are they just, would they just turn into another communist state? And it wouldn't. It seems like it's too small to really bother with, unless it's a point of pride and arrogance.
Economically, economically,
okay.
Taiwan is a powerhouse.
Oh, okay. How big is the economy?
Because it has a free market capitalist system economy.
Uh-huh.
Didn't always, by the way. It was not always the liberal, you know, democratic system representative country that it is right now. It was not always. Under the Kuomintang, in the first decades after the Kuomintang fled there, it was a dictatorship. But it gradually modernized. It gradually democratized to where now it is absolutely westernized in its liberal democratic style form of government. It is an economic powerhouse in terms of GDP and output, no matter how small and you know how small the population. But this is what China cannot stand, you see, because the model of this little teeny tiny island, you know, being so successful, shames mainland China, which has nothing of the sort. And, you know, whose people live under tyranny and whose economy, you know, stutters and starts and stops because of centralized planning, which is never a good model. Doesn't work. But they
doesn't
can't admit
here.
That because then they would lose power, right?
Okay.
So the as long as Taiwan exists, as it exists, a free, you know, independent entity with a thriving economy, it puts mainland China, Beijing, and the CCP to shame, and you know that they cannot stand.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's like a safe face kind of thing, even though it's not economically, it wouldn't make that much difference to China because they've got a huge economy. It's just communist, you know, completely centrally controlled one, she said. Is there much trade between Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan, for example? Do they have their own little
trading
group?
Oh yes, quite a lot.
Trading group?
Oh yes, very much.
All right.
And with mainland China too.
Oh.
Yeah, a lot.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Sure.
I have a feeling that, and I got Jean and Lita in the line also. If you want to join in the conversation, feel free. We got about 60 minutes left. I had this feeling that the world leaders of Japan and India, the Quad, Australia, they're becoming more partners than it used to be, where the United States would be the leader of this group. Are they kind of hoping to get by Biden without China invading Taiwan? You know, so we get a better position with our next president, whoever it is. Are they kind of hoping for the best and still preparing?
I think they are realizing that under the Biden administration, that they really are much more on their own to defend themselves and their own neighborhood.
That's not a bad thing.
Although, you know, I will say that the Biden team has taken some good steps. As you know, I supported the submarine deal with Australia, although I thought it could have been handled a lot more diplomatically with France. But nevertheless... And I support, stronger alignment and the ties among the Quad countries. Those are positive things. Those are good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, India, for example, India's got nuclear weapons. I know that. And I know they have an Air Force and Army. Does India have any kind of a Navy? Would they be able to go through the Taiwan Straits? Okay.
I don't know that they actually patrol that far to the east in the South China Sea. But they are surrounded by water. I mean,
That's why I was curious.
Asian continent is surrounded, by the Indian Ocean. It's called the Indian Ocean.
I know that. I know they have the water. I wasn't questioning that. My question was, did they have a navy to sail on it or under it?
Oh, sure. It's not a blue water navy, though, quote unquote, that has a global presence. It is more of a nearby, a localized presence.
More like a Coast Guard?
But of course, the waters around India are vast. They're humongous.
Okay.
That's plenty.
But I would think that India would do joint operations with Japan, for example, if they could do that. And I don't know how much Japan's still limited.
I don't know that is happening right now, no.
Okay. Is Japan still under strict limitations for their Navy, particularly and Air Force? Let's talk about both of those. You know, from back with the old World War II limitations, or are they pretty much free to
develop
their defenses?
Things are loosening up, shall we say.
Okay. All right.
They know that they have to defend themselves. They know that their islands are under threat by the CCP.
Right.
It's not just Taiwan. They're defending Taiwan, yes, but with an absolute view to their own defense as well, because China claims Japanese islands as its own. And, of course, the nine-dash line includes, vast territory that includes the exclusive economic zones of not just Japan, but, of course, Taiwan and the Philippines and many other nations in the Pacific of that area.
Yeah, I mean, I think they all have an interest. You know, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, I think all these countries down there would have an interest.
Take a look at the nine-dash line and how much it includes,
What's the nine-dash line? That's a new term.
Right. The nine-dash line is a line that the Chinese Communist Party around the waters of the South China Sea and into the Pacific Ocean. And it's called nine-dash line because it's drawn with nine line dashes.
Okay.
And that nine-dash line encompasses just about all of the South China Sea and encroaches entirely on the exclusive economic zones, as I've said, of Taiwan, of Japan, of Indonesia, of Malaysia, of the Philippines, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, it's interesting. I got to see this on a map, but it strikes me as very similar to the area that Japan took in World War II. And I wonder if there's still – does China still have a vindictive, vendetta against Japan for World War II and is part of that in what's going on here, or they just want the territory and the resources, or both?
Well, of course, the memories are still there, naturally, but Japan today is not the Japan of World War II. It's completely different.
Right.
So it's not about that. So much
I was wondering about China's perspective on it, though.
It's the aggressive expansionist ambitions of the CCP.
Okay. Which is not the China of old either. that's a whole different thing, too.
In terms of naval expansion, but land expansion goes back, 3,000, 4,000 years.
Yeah. Yeah, we should do. It'd be interesting to do a little ancient history on the dynasties of China, especially because we think of history, you know, in terms of, you know, first of all, American history, which is what, from 1600 ish.
I mean, 245 years old.
Years compared old. To, you know, and then you look at China and Japan and Korea, which what 7,000 plus years of history.
Well, maybe not. I mean, there were people there that long, but you know, you're talking about civilizations that grew up in the Yellow River Valley and the Pearl River and all, the Mekong and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly 3,000 years, the Qin Dynasty
okay.
is often, you know, thought of as yeah. The dynasty that united China for the first time under one emperor.
I just think it's part of history that if we study it a little bit more, it'd give us a better understanding for what's going on there. So we've got about 10 minutes left. And again, please bring up a topic. If I haven't covered something that you think needs to be covered, I mean, you know, I always have questions, but I'd rather have, you know, if this is something that you think. I've got another one from your video, the videos that you sent, which I post on Facebook, Afghanistan. Let's talk about what's going on there. The first question I have on that is I sort of speculated from news reports that I have, like fragments of information in my head, that the Taliban didn't just walk in and take over Afghanistan as soon as we withdrew. That they've been working on this for months, and I'm wondering how far back it goes. Does it go back to the usurpation of the White House by Biden? Does it go back to January when they started taking territory? Were there secret deals involved?
No, it goes
involved?
Back
were
to the middle 1990s when the Taliban was formed. And if you want to take it back even further, it goes back to the 1980s when the constituent warlord entities of the Taliban were being supported and funded and financed by the United States to fight off the Soviet Red Army. That's how far back it goes.
Is it the Mujahideen?
The Mujahideen were comprised of various warlord militias that we helped to fight off the Soviet Red Army at a time when the Soviet Union was our number one global strategic adversary.
Right. And they're Afghanistan. We laughed at them.
Entities in the middle 1990s, excuse me, when the Pakistani ISI, which is still deeply involved, I mean, they completely run the place, more or less, when the Pakistani ISI not only co-opted a bunch of those warlords, but also then sent off armed, fund, trained the students. That's what Taliban means, students.
Students,
out
yeah,
of
you,
the madrasas
you, I remember you saying
of
that,
Pashtun
yeah.
land, meaning yeah. on both sides of the border, Afghanistan, Pakistan. So that's how far back it goes. I mean, this is nothing recent. This is decades old.
Yeah, but what I'm thinking of, you know, I mean, I know that our forces beat them back, you know, and it was kind of like, I don't know where it stood, but it seems to me that just in the most recent history, in the last year, you know, from since January until, you know, Biden's surrender, which is what I'm calling it, it seems to me that that weren't several capitals taken, several provinces were taken. I mean, the Taliban was growing in strength, you know, over the months before
yeah.
we actually
I mean, the
withdrew.
Taliban, the Taliban
How did that
was,
happen?
Was seizing provinces and provincial capitals on a very steady basis ever since 9/11. I mean, I don't okay. think people understand the continuity of the Taliban's fight. It's not new. The final push just happened, yes. But
okay.
but the steady fight against the Afghan National Army forces and our support for them, NATO support for them, that's been
mm-hmm.
going on for decades. And we were not winning. We might have been barely holding them off from a complete takeover of the entire country,
mm-hmm.
but we weren't winning. And the Taliban were steadily gobbling up provinces ever since 9/11.
Okay.
So it's not like something new. It came to our attention because of the final push, you know, the final advance on Kabul. It's not like this happened all of a sudden. This has been going on for decades.
So I think that's the impression, though.
By province.
Yeah. So we've spent 20 years doing what in 6 minutes?
Holding off the final offensive, yes.
Okay.
Writing a Sharia constitution for the Afghan people that was promulgated in 2004.
Mm-hmm. I remember putting
Afghanistan under Islamic law. We did that. Well, our State Department did that. Zalmay Khalilzad, ambassador. Mm-hmm. By the way, the same ambassador who led the surrender talks in Doha that go back to the Obama years.
Yeah.
All of this was going on for a long time. People just weren't paying attention. The only reason we're paying attention now is because the final offensive took place and Kabul fell. That's the only reason we're paying attention now. But it's been going on for decades.
Yeah. Yeah, like I say, I don't think there's a general awareness of that. The other thing here I discovered, this new State Department collaboration. It's a State Department collaboration with Welcome U.S. So the 100,000-plus Afghanis and plus all their relatives will make it probably over a million by the time they all get here. Rather than take them back, like they should, of course they're not going to do that, this resettlement program now has an official department within the State Department. So it seems to me, as I say, that I believe this has always been by design, that the Obama forces, you know, in the Biden, you know, I can't say administration, you know, insurrection, that they've always wanted this. Now they have a special office in the State Department set up. You know, and this plus Catholic Charities plus the other organizations, this is a well-coordinated effort to resettle a whole lot of people.
The actual fact of this goes back many, many presidents. I mean, many, many presidents, including Trump. The way the international refugee resettlement system works is the UN High Commissioner on Refugees selects, does the first cut of those who want to be resettled someplace else than where they're at, war zone, disaster zone, whatever it may be around the world. And then the UNHCR contacts various nation states that are willing to take them. And they negotiate with those nation states at their Minister of Foreign Affairs, or for us, the Department of State level, how many will you take? Okay, we'll take 120,000 this year, or whatever it may be. This goes back presidents upon presidents, okay? This is nothing new. Okay. And there are 9 in the United States major contractors, NGOs they're called, which contract directly with the Department of State to resettle refugees, and they're paid on a per-head, per-capita basis. They include Catholic Charities, the Methodists, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, go on and on. There are 9 of them, major NGOs. They bypass the state governments, the governors, the state legislatures, because according to federal law, this is a federal matter. And until Congress changes that by law, it remains so. The State Department contracts with the NGOs. The NGOs bring the people in by bus or plane or whatever and dump them in your local backyard. And there's not a single thing the states can do about it. They have no input and no say-so until we get Congress to change that law.
Do you know where it is in law? Do you know the title by chance? Or give me a place
to start
looking.
There is no law. I mean, there are a couple of bills that have been proposed years since. For example, Brian Babin, representative out of Texas, and also out of the Gettysburg area of Pennsylvania representative, I'm so sorry I'm blanking on his name, have proposed bills long time since to give states and state legislatures input and say-so about who, how many, how vetted, where from refugees would be resettled and immigrants in their local states. Scott Perry is what I'm trying to think of from Pennsylvania. But these bills never went anywhere because it's too lucrative. It's a very lucrative business.
Yeah, I've done a show on refugees. I did a whole thing on $1.2 billion that's given out to these agencies. And then, believe me, I'm just investigating them. So I have plans already to look into some of these NGOs, non-government organizations. I was just curious.
Well, there's nothing illegal about it. It's completely legal.
Well,
the problem is that it's legal.
And until
we change that in Congress, it remains so.
Okay. Well, you know, we're a citizen legislature. This is what I do. So what I want to do is, if you know the title of where the current law is, of where the law is that allows them to do this. If you don't, I can look it up, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, I don't know it offhand, there's too much money in this to change it. I mean, nobody, besides Brian Babin and Scott Perry, nobody in Congress wants to touch this. They don't want to change it. They're not going to vote to change this. It's too lucrative. Nobody's going to change it.
but I just feel determined to do that. Looks like Jonathan's joining us for the last minute.
Oh, good.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to say I loved the sessions earlier, but I know you're out of time.
We are, but listen, you can come back tomorrow or you know, next week. We're fine.
I hope
Claire,
so.
Thank you. Jonathan,
yeah,
thanks for joining us.
On.
Oh, yeah, this is a record show today, just the amount of information, the new information we have. So, Claire, I hope you get a chance to listen to us and of course, share your portion of this as well as with the show. This is all fascinating. Anything we should be looking forward for next week, Claire? Areas to look at?
Who knows, right?
Yeah. Okay. Just curious.
I'll be back.
Yeah, we'll have both of you back regular time next week, so this will be good. But I had to get John in, and it was fast because Jonathan couldn't make it this morning. All right, listen, everybody, we've got 20 seconds left. I want to thank you, Gene, for producing, and Claire, and Jonathan, and John Cullen, and Josie for calling in even when we disagree. And that's what makes this show fun. I have a bunch of things to follow up on with John Cullen, particularly legislation that I wrote a year ago that now maybe we can do something about because he knows people that I don't know. So let's see who he knows, and maybe we can start having some more impact here. Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Back tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock Central Time, 7 o'clock Eastern.
Have a good day.